You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week John Kiriakou. He is a former CIA officer who in 2007 became the first U.S. government official to publicly confirm and describe the CIA's use of waterboarding on Al-Qaeda prisoners, which he described as torture. In January 2013, John Kiriakou was sentenced to 30 months in prison and was released after serving more than 23 months. Since then, he has become a tireless writer and speaker on whistleblowing, torture, and civil liberties. He is also the only U.S. government official to have been put in jail for any reason related to CIA torture, even though he didn't torture anybody. John Kiriakou, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much. Very happy to be with you.
Great to have you on here. You are going to be the recipient of this year's Sam Adams Award for Integrity in Intelligence. What do you know about that? This award and its other recipients?
Oh, I've been following the Sam Adams Award for years. And first of all, I have to say how humbled I am to be in the presence of these giants who make up the Sam Adams Award Committee. It's people I've admired in many cases from a distance over more than a decade. So just to be associated with them is so thrilling for me. I'm really looking forward to this ceremony.
I know at least a few past recipients are planning to be at the ceremony, which is going to be 4 p.m. Sunday, September 26th at American University in Washington, D.C. in the Kay Center Chapel. And this is going to be sort of at the very end of a three-day conference, No War 2016 conference that people can register for at worldbeyondwar.org. Or go there and watch the live stream. But Larry Wilkerson, Thomas Drake, whistleblower, past recipient, Larry Johnson, possibly Ambassador Craig Murray, although the U.S. State Department seems reluctant to let him into the country.
I'm outraged by this whole Ambassador Craig Murray situation. Craig Murray is a hero. Craig Murray is a whistleblower in his own right. He was the British ambassador to Uzbekistan in the early 2000s, and he blew the whistle on the Uzbek torture program. The Uzbeks were torturing their own people, in many cases, at the behest of the United States.
Yeah.
And so he fell afoul of his own government. He was recalled back to London, forced into retirement, nearly lost his pension, although in the end he was able to save it. And he's been a hero for other whistleblowers and anti-torture activists around the world. So here's a greatly honored former ambassador who has been to the United States literally dozens of times, never with any kind of problem. He's never been accused of a crime. He's certainly never been charged with any crime. And then, just coincidentally, as he wants to come to Washington to attend the Sam Adams Award ceremony and to present me with this award, he finds himself banned by the United States.
They are claiming, as at the moment as we speak, that anyone from one of these countries that typically gets to waive visa requirements who's been to Iraq, Iran, Sudan, or I think Somalia since 2011 can no longer do that and has to get a visa. And because Craig Murray has been to Iraq, even though, you know, Iraq has supposedly been liberated and so forth, that's a problem.
It's also my understanding that he was invited to Iraq by the government of Iraq. And so it's not that he surreptitiously slipped in across the border from Turkey or something.
Sure.
He was invited as a guest of the Iraqi government. That policy that you just enunciated is an important policy to stop potential terrorists from entering the U.S. So if you are an ethnic Somali teenager from Toronto and you went to Somalia for however long, and then you want to come into the United States, okay, yeah, great. We should look at your case. But if you're a retired British ambassador who traveled to Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government. That's not why this policy was written.
Yeah, well, we're making a lot of noise about it in the United Kingdom and the United States, and people can go to diy.rootsaction.org and sign a petition that you've signed and many important people have signed and thousands of people have signed, and hopefully it'll make a difference. I wanted to ask you also, John, I was happy to see you at an early screening of this new film on Edward Snowden, and this show will be airing after the embargo on talking about that film, and I wondered, what was your impression of that story of a whistleblower, and how did it compare to your own? I mean, as I was struck, of course, by the thousands of colleagues of Ed Snowden who knew what he knew and said nothing, but also how darn long it took him, how many crimes and abuses he sat through before he came around in his mind to become a whistleblower.
Yes. Jesselyn Radack, who's an attorney representing whistleblowers, Jesselyn represents both Ed Snowden and me, once told me, actually in our very first meeting, I said to her, I want to thank you so much for taking my case, but I have to tell you, I'm not a whistleblower. And she said, but you are a whistleblower. And I said, I'm not. I remained silent for 5.5 years, and I never said anything. And she said, look, first, no whistleblower ever thinks he's a whistleblower. Second, there's a legal definition of whistleblowing, and that is bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. So she said, you're the poster boy for whistleblowers, and there will be others. And certainly, less than 2 years later, there was Ed Snowden. That movie, Oliver Stone's Snowden, it was cinematically beautiful. It was brilliantly written and acted and directed. It was chock full of stars. But I had a knot in the pit of my stomach through that entire film. And I had this pit, or this knot in the pit of my stomach, because it was like watching a slow motion train wreck. Here's a guy who wants so desperately to do the right thing, but he knows that it's just not going to end well. Our governments don't want us to do the right thing when it comes to the national security state, whether it's torture or secret prisons or warrantless wiretapping. Nothing good is going to come of your whistleblowing. Now, my belief, my position on Ed Snowden is that he is an American hero and that he has done a public service, the likes of which we haven't seen in a generation. Really, two generations since the Pentagon Papers and Daniel Ellsberg. So I think Ed Snowden should be rewarded for his heroism. He should be invited to come home to attend his own ticker tape parade in New York. One thing that made me really happy, David, was the way Oliver Stone told Snowden's story in just a plain, linear fashion so that any American can understand Ed's motivation and can understand the good that he did for the country.
Yeah, this is what always strikes me about whistleblowers and anti-war activist veterans. It's never the people who sort of quietly fumble along apathetically and obey their orders and go home and don't really care about their job. It's the true believers, the enthusiastic advocates of spying and torturing and killing and bombing for the good of the world.
Right.
Who, when they figure out that it's actually hurting the world, switch and have the courage to take risks and have the skill to blow the whistle. I mean, is this your impression? Did you go from enthusiastic true believer to whistleblower?
I was a true believer when it came to terrorism. I wasn't unique in this respect, but I was one of many CIA officers who opposed the Iraq War. Many of us just thought it was a disaster and that it was a war crime. But yeah, when it came to terrorism, I was a true believer. Like everybody else in the building, on the afternoon of September 11th, 2001, I volunteered to go to Afghanistan and to fight or to do anything the CIA wanted me to do. And indeed, I found myself in Pakistan a couple months later as the chief of CIA counterterrorism operations. So, yeah, I believed that we were the good guys. There was no doubt in my mind until I got back and was first approached about this torture program that we were the good guys.
Yeah. But these operations, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan, seem to, if anything, be increasing terrorism rather than reducing or much less eliminating it.
I think that's exactly what happened. I think that the fact that we are in a permanent state of war, that we have transitioned to a permanent wartime economy, and that we are bombing something like 7 countries or 9 countries right now as we speak, has done nothing but to perpetuate this constant war. I think this is a disservice to the American people. I think that in many cases we're committing crimes against other countries, and we need a policy change immediately.
Yeah, it seemed predictable, and yet we have a society, a culture in which very smart, well-educated people like you and like Ed Snowden in this movie, who's introduced as a smart conservative in the beginning, believe that war and militarism is somehow going to be helpful.
Yes.
And then through experience figure out otherwise. How do we manage to educate so many thousands of young people who, in some cases are, computer geniuses like Ed Snowden or very skilled at the job they're doing like you were, to believe such nonsense?
Oh boy, that's the $64,000 question. I'm frequently asked variations of that question on college campuses around the country. And I used to think that, well, maybe I ought to be a realist, and I know the CIA is not going away, and really the only way to change the CIA is to do it from the inside. Maybe I should be encouraging young people to apply to the CIA. After 10 or 12 years, they'll find themselves in a position of authority, and they can maybe change it. That's silly. That's just never going to work. We need to fight on Capitol Hill. We need to protest in the streets. And I think most importantly, we need to be litigious bastards about this. And we need to find people standing to sue the CIA and the national security state at every opportunity. And I'll give you an example. There's a group, an anti-torture group in North Carolina, that began by protesting at a small municipal airport where the CIA was keeping its rendition aircraft. And they were largely ignored. Even the local, yokel, small-town papers ignored them. But they never gave up the fight. And from protesting, they went to blocking the road. And then they went to sit-ins inside the terminal building. And they just sort of upped the ante at every opportunity. Finally, they sued, and they filed a federal suit. They actually lost the federal suit, but they were enough of a pain to the owner of this airport that he finally asked the CIA to just leave. And if we're patient and we take those kinds of actions and we're not afraid to sue and to be real jerks about it, maybe we can see some successes.
It's a good lesson. It should be a model for others. I know that at Shannon Airport in Ireland, they're attempting the same. It's a shame, John, that you are the only one who has gone to prison over this this criminal enterprise. Maybe some other people need to go there. We look very much forward to seeing you receive this award on September 26th, the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence. John Kiriakou, thanks for what you're doing and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
It is my great pleasure to welcome Elizabeth Murray to Talk Nation Radio. Elizabeth Murray was Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East in the National Intelligence Council before retiring from the CIA after 27 years. She is now a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and of Sam Adams Associates, the organization awarding the award for integrity in intelligence to John Kiriakou. She is also member in residence of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. Elizabeth Murray, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, David.
So you're doing, I've introduced Anne Wright, I can't count how many times, with that retired after 27 years line. I think it was the same number of years. How did you come to spend 27 years with the U.S. government and the CIA, and now are participating with me in a conference on abolishing the institution of war? It seems like quite a switch.
It was a little bit of a journey, David. I initially had intended to spend only 3 years in the government. My first job out of college was as a journalist, believe it or not, back in 1982 and early 1983. And I had this opportunity to join what I then didn't realize what was part of the CIA. It was called the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, and that was actually the open source arm of the Central Intelligence Agency, where news from around the world, hard news from different countries, was monitored and translated into English and then analyzed so that our policymakers could understand what foreign leaders were saying about our country, what foreign newspapers thought about our political actions, and we would then sort of give out full texts of those leader speeches and those editorials, and also tell our policymakers what those issues, what the leaders' statements were implying for U.S. policy. So it was very innocent, actually, on my part, and it was only later when I expressed interest and a letter came back to me on CIA letterhead that I thought, whoa, but the job itself sounded so interesting. I was going to be hired as an editor and travel abroad. So I jumped and thought to myself, okay, you know, I didn't know much about the CIA at that time. I really didn't. And so I thought, I'm not going to be in the sinister dark side. I'm going to be doing interesting reports and making the, you know, helping our policymakers do a better job. So I thought 3 years, and then I was learning so much, and I got to travel to England and then to the Middle East. The 3 years turned into 6 years and turned into 16 years. And before I knew it, I was there for 27 years. But I have to say that being in the government was definitely very educational. I learned to speak Arabic. I traveled and lived in the Middle East for several years. And actually, my eyes were opened to many of those very government policies that I've criticized in my own writings and in my demonstrations against the various wars and such. So, you know, everything has two sides, you know, positive and negative, and I think I took both from my government experience.
It's funny. It sounds like exactly what many of us have always said the government should be doing more of. That is, instead of, you know, locking up and torturing some poor schmuck whose neighbor had a grudge against him and fantasizing that you can invade a country and be welcomed as liberators, you ought to start reading foreign newspapers and learning about foreign governments and cultures and translating what they're saying on their networks. And so, I mean, that seems like exactly what you say you were doing. Somehow the wisdom isn't filtering up to the decision makers.
Well, David, that's just it. I did that sort of work for 27 years before, and I was actually working at a building in Reston, Virginia, which dealt exclusively with the open source side. And it was actually when I left that open source branch of the government, it was because it was in, let's see, it was in actually just after the United States invaded Iraq. It was because I was feeling myself also increasingly under pressure in a way that I hadn't felt before, to make my writings useful to people who were using it for different reasons. For example, in the run-up to the war itself was just starting. The U.S. had just invaded, and I was at my desk, and at that time I was in charge of you know, Iraqi media. This was in early 2003, and I was getting calls from people in the Pentagon saying, well, tell me about this new Iraqi paper that's just come up after, you know, the Americans have invaded. Is it pro-USA or anti-USA? And I would try to explain as best as possible, well, you know, they like Americans and they appreciate that you know, Saddam is, you know, not in power anymore, but they really want the Americans to leave and they don't like the occupation. And then, David, this actually happened a day or two after I talked to this person. I read in the paper that American troops had gone into the office of this newspaper in Baghdad and completely ransacked it and threw out the computers and God knows what happens to the staff. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I don't like the way, I think my skills are being used badly now. and so I wasn't as enthusiastic. And of course, you probably know now that the side of the CIA that I was on, which was actually back in the day, was very separate. At one time, we even had separate cafeterias for the operative CIA people who live in a completely different world and were compartmented, and the people who just did the intelligence reports. And now we have a situation where I believe John Brennan came out a year or so ago and said he wanted these two sides to increasingly integrate, and now there are these fusion groups. And so basically now in the CIA you find that intelligence officers are actually serving the ends of the operations side, and that's supposed to be, you know, supporting administration policy rather than the, you know, our old credo used to be, you know, be independent, tell it like it is, and that was really fun, actually. I have to tell you, I had a lot of fun the first 20 years because we had a lot of independence. We were physically separated from Langley, Virginia, where CIA real headquarters is, and our views were respected. We didn't have the political pressure that came to bear later when administration pressure, you know, or other pressures on us, including from the Pentagon, from Wolfowitz's office, were pushing us to find, you know, pick and choose parts of the media that showed that Saddam was someone that needed to be overthrown, or that there were these weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, everyone knows, you know, there weren't any. So, you're right that I think the original purpose of the CIA probably should have been, and frankly, I think actually was, just to provide this unprejudiced information to policymakers. And then there were these other people that had, I guess, worked for the OSS, and someone decided to shoehorn them into the new CIA. I guess this was in 1947. And give them something to do, and look where that's brought us. So, I agree.
All right, which Truman claimed to regret later, and wrote about negatively. I think it was on the 1 year anniversary of the killing of Kennedy, as I recall. But as you know, Elizabeth, I grew up in Reston, and I think I know the building you're referring to. It is not kept terribly secret. It sounds like a job of almost speaking truth to power from very close up, that is, telling decision makers in the U.S. government what's actually happening in the world and what people around the world actually think, and then watching that information be ignored. Is that
right,
a fair
ignored
description?
Ignored, or even worse, David, skewed in a way that makes it serve sort of, you know, violent aims or aims that would take us to war. So yeah, you know, it's sad when you see your own intelligence or your own information that you've worked hard or others have worked hard to translate, you know, being cherry picked and used for really ugly purposes, and I think that's what happened with the war on Iraq, and that's what that sort of, you know, found me then, you know, marching in the streets with the anti-war movement, and I actually got in trouble at work later. Back in 2007, I found myself at the gates of Kennebunkport, Maine, protesting at the Bush compound with a bunch of anti-war protesters, and somehow a photo of me holding up an anti-war sign made it back to my supervisor. By this time, I was at Langley as a Saudi Arabia political analyst, and I was called into a room and asked, you know, what is this? And I just said, well, what do you mean, what is this? I'm exercising my constitutional rights. But They didn't see it that way, and they said that you know, my credibility would be jeopardized if I were to go downtown and brief, you know, people on the Capitol Hill, and if this picture, you know, had come out. So I thought to myself, I see. So I have credibility if I were to go to Iraq, for example, and support the war in my capacity as an analyst, you know, in the Green Zone, which of course I didn't do. But somehow, if I'm in an anti-war demonstration, that's, you know, not credible. So after that, I noticed that I was not given any decent assignments, and I was sort of given secretarial tasks to do. And, you know, I think they really wanted me to disappear at that point. And almost out of rebellion, I thought, you know, no, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to see what's happening around me, and I'm going to make note of it. And then I'm going to tell the American people what they deserve to know about it. And, you know, when I did retire, and after I met Ray McGovern and got into Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, I started writing, certainly not about the highly classified things that I had access to, but certainly about the things that I felt the American people deserved to know about what was going on inside the government. And, you know, one of those things was the pressure that I came under from Paul Wolfowitz's office to find the connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein in the run-up to the Iraq War. They kept barraging me with calls, and I kept calling them back and saying, we've researched it, and we found there's no connection. This was back in early 2003 between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And, of course, you know, that didn't serve their purposes, and of course, I didn't get promoted very quickly in my line of work. But there also were people who were willing to find those connections and do things and probably did very well career-wise. But analysts were put under tremendous pressure to come up with things it was implied that there was a relationship and that we hadn't found the evidence. But in the end, I mean, my response to that office, it was the Office of Special Plans, was to say, well, tell me where you got tell me where you got this information in the first place. What is your source? And then maybe that will help me do my research and find out, you know, how to find this connection. And, of course, they never got back to me for obvious reasons.
Elizabeth Murray, we have about 1 minute left. What would you advise people today? Is there a value in going to work for the Pentagon or the State Department or the CIA and trying to make things a little less horrifically, awfully, criminally immoral? Or are you better off trying to influence from the outside?
You know, it's funny. I think that's giving advice like that is I get asked like that all the time. But I think that it is important to have good people in on the inside. And, you know, if you're a person of integrity, you can probably do a lot of good on the inside. You will have opportunities to influence and to talk with your colleagues and maybe to question things that otherwise wouldn't be questioned. And that's what I found. I mean, I was definitely the odd person out, and met many of these people that I interacted with inside the government. You know, who you never know how you're going to affect them or how you're going to change them.
Yeah.
Also, government offers the chance to travel and.
I wish we had more time to go into it. Perhaps someone going in planning to be a whistleblower, I could see a rationalization for. But thank you for what you've done and look forward to seeing you in Washington.
Okay, David, thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you wouldn't know it from the corporate media, but what may have been the largest prison labor strike in the country's history happened September 9th after months of organizing. Prisoners hope to call attention to a range of complaints about conditions, including forced labor. This country is supposedly taking a bipartisan fresh look at mass incarceration. So what does elite media's collective yawn say about their actual interest in what happens to people once they're behind bars? We'll hear from investigative journalist and prison radio director Noel Hanrahan. Also on the show, Wells Fargo being fined once again for fraud. This time it's signing customers up for accounts they didn't ask for in order to meet sales goals. The CEO will supposedly answer questions at a congressional hearing, but is there any sense we're any closer to asking the right questions of the banking industry? Former financial regulator William Black is associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He'll help us sort through the Wells Fargo story. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. The September 6th New York Times featured a profile of Driscoll's, described by reporter Stephanie Strom as the family-owned berry juggernaut. No other company in the world grows berries exactly like these, readers were told. Driscoll's is betting that once consumers know why its berries are distinctive, they will demand them by name, readers were told. The company's YouTube channel will feature stories told by consumers about why berries make them happy. The strawberries trace their heritage to the late 1800s when Aunt Lou came home from a trip with some plants. All of this, readers were told by the New York Times. What readers would have no clue about would be the 3 years of organizing, the walkouts, picket lines, and lawsuits over labor violations, leading to Driscoll's being the subject of a pretty high-profile international boycott. Wage theft, poverty wages, hostile and unhealthy conditions, all of these have been reported. One of the workers' lawsuits went to the Washington State Supreme Court. They won a 2015 decision that ensured paid rest breaks for farm workers statewide. The New York Times story comes with a slideshow in which company owners get a portrait, but farm workers' faces are hidden. Contrast it with the work of labor photojournalist David Bacon, who has profiled Driscoll's farm workers, including Felimon Pineda, vice president of Familias Unidas por la Justicia, the independent union from Washington State. After the Times piece ran, farm workers at major Driscoll supplier Sakuma Brothers Farms voted to join that union, and they've called for a suspension of the boycott. A story in Washington's The Stranger reported on a celebration. It noted a banner that read, "A victory for our children," and another saying, "Respect the people who grow your food." Somebody alert the Times. Well, the drumbeat of Trump as Russian agent probably won't stop until Election Day. Adam Johnson noted that one subgenre of this line of thinking, that Russia will literally hack our election process and throw the U.S. into a dystopian constitutional crisis, appears to be being mainstreamed, due in good part to the Washington Post. A September 5th Post story followed the provocative headline, undermined down the page, formula. Up top, U.S. investigating potential covert Russian plan to disrupt November elections. Five paragraphs down, quote, "The official cautioned that the intelligence community is not saying it has definitive proof of such tampering or any Russian plans to do so," close quote. Well, government officials investigating something, no matter how implausible, could still be said to be newsworthy. But that story was followed 3 days later by an op-ed by Post contributor Ann Applebaum that lists a series of increasingly goofy scenarios in which Russia could spark a U.S. electoral disaster, as the headline has it. One involves Russian hackers breaking into the voting system, which Applebaum says has already happened in Arizona. That's not true. There have been accusations of Russian hacking of voter data in Arizona, but that's separate from the actual voting system you'd need to hack to change vote tallies. If only that slip were the end of it, though. Scenario four is, quote, the Russians attempt to throw the election. They might try to get Trump elected. Alternatively, and this would, of course, be even more devastating, they might try to rig the election for Clinton, perhaps leaving a trail of evidence designed to connect the rigging operation to Clinton's campaign, close quote. So that's a double-layered false flag of election rigging, if you're following. But hang on to your hat for scenario number five. Quote, once revealed, the result will be media hysteria, hearings, legal challenges, mass rallies, a constitutional crisis, followed by confusion, chaos, and an undermining of the office of the presidency. Trump might emerge from the process as president after all. He will then go on, as promised at so many rallies, to lock her up, and of course to open a broad relation with Russian President Vladimir Putin, the only foreign leader he seems to truly admire. Even if Clinton remains as president, she will be tarnished. At least a part of the country will assume she is illegitimate, that the elites and Clinton clan and the mainstream media stole the election from the people, close quote. Well, as Johnson says, it's unclear now whether we're reading real political analysis or a rejected script for 24. But it would be funny if it weren't in the major daily of the nation's capital. Applebaum goes on to say that probably none of this will happen, but that that's not the point because, quote, rumors of election fraud can create the same hysteria as real election fraud, close quote, which at this point sounds like self-parody. Voting manipulation is no joke, and evidence-based discussions could be useful. But running away with wholly speculative scenarios built on speculative scenarios while hand-wringing about hysteria and mass rallies isn't informative. It's just cynical fear-mongering. And finally, when Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman asked security guards at the Dakota Access Pipeline construction project why they were using pepper spray and dogs to attack Native American protesters, the guards backed off, taking their mace and attack dogs with them. It was a clear lesson in how journalism can defend the rights of citizens. The state of North Dakota had a response to this kind of journalism. It issued a warrant for Goodman's arrest, charging her with criminal trespassing. This is an extraordinary action. Jack McDonald, a lawyer for the North Dakota Newspaper Association and for the Bismarck Tribune, told the Tribune that in 40 years of doing media law in the state, he's never heard of a reporter being charged with trespassing. So, how did journalists respond to one of their own being threatened with arrest for doing her job? Mostly, they ignored it. The story was covered locally in the Bismarck Tribune and the Duluth News Tribune. It was covered internationally in the British Guardian and in a mention in the Toronto Star. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's representative on freedom of the media and the Committee to Protect Journalists issued statements. But most national U.S. outlets, the ones who complain about not getting a seat on a candidate's plane, breathed not a word on North Dakota's assault on the press's ability to cover a major story of the moment. The internet-based Salon and Mashable deserve credit as exceptions. Elite media coverage of a million issues makes clear that they don't mind taking sides. It's a real shame they won't take the side of the right to do journalism when and where it matters. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Thousands of prisoners in some 24 states engaged in a work strike September 9th, protesting their forced labor for no or little pay, along with a number of other dangerous and unhealthy conditions and practices that confront the more than 2 million people incarcerated in the United States. Corporate media could barely have shown less interest. One CBS report, an AP story, and some local accounts in Florida and Alabama were about it as we tape on September 15th. The U.S., we're told, is engaged in a newly serious conversation about mass incarceration. Leave it to elite media to think they can host that conversation without talking to incarcerated people. Joining us to talk about the strike and the issues behind it is Noelle Hanrahan. She's an investigative journalist, a private investigator, and the director of the multimedia production studio Prison Radio. She joins us by phone from Philadelphia. Welcome back to Counterspin, Noelle Hanrahan.
Thank you for having me.
Well, invoking slavery to describe prison labor, as we've heard some inmate organizers do, is not metaphor, really. The 13th Amendment outlawed slavery in 1865, quote, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, close quote. What are some of the work conditions and other conditions that striking prisoners were hoping to direct attention to?
I think we really have to realize that all of the prison systems in this country are based on prison labor. They couldn't run without the prisoners. So 98% of all the work done to maintain these extensive housing projects, this vast amount of public housing really, is done by prisoners. And that's the main work. There are other companies that come in and use workers, but it's not the main problem. The main problem is the warehousing of a workforce. So people are targeted for mass incarceration in this country like no other country in the world. One in 99 people are in prison. One in 46 people will do prison time. And if you add in race, one in three black men will do prison time. So the economy is targeting people by race, by class, and by place. What they need humanely, education, resources, work, jobs, and a society that provides for everyone.
Well, it's interesting that you're talking about the prison as an economy, which is certainly the frame of this strike, but I think it may be a new way of seeing it for some people. The Free Alabama movement is key here as prison organizers, and the co-founder, Kinetic Justice, made exactly this point that he said, we tried petitioning the courts. We tried appealing to legislators about our conditions. You know, we wrote letters. We did all of that with the political process, and it didn't work. And we realized that this is an economic enterprise. And so now we're organizing around our labor.
There are two ways of looking at it. One is, say if you're outside of prisons, every single budget decision in local, state, county, federal, is based almost entirely on what we're spending for our prisons. We make a choice. We're spending money on prisons and warehousing people or preschools. I mean, the same could be said about war as well. But these are two huge ticket items, right? Now, the other thing is, inside prisons, there's a vast amount of people, millions, 2 million, you know, more cities and jails and county jails. We're talking about in a place where people are oppressed and that the conditions that they suffer are extreme and are very biased, very, very, very akin to slavery. If people refuse to go to work, if they refuse to get in line, if they refuse to do those simplest things, they are often brutalized in the extreme. And they are often put in isolation and control units and holes. Almost every single institution in the United States has a segregation unit that is used as a punishment unit. They use calorie reduction. Many of the hunger strikes that we've seen and some of the other protests that we've seen were based on penalties for limited calories, that they were actually taking people's food and visits and clothing.
And you're making the point that it's an economic issue inside the prison, then also an economic issue for the local area in which that prison is situated.
The bodies of prisoners are commodities, and we can see this in a number of ways. When upstate or rural areas have prisons situated in them, they get added representation, added congresspeople. Now, the prisoners are barred from voting. But the communities where those prisoners are warehoused and stored have added representation. So that's just one clear example of how they commodify bodies of prisoners.
Well, I did want to note this one report on CBS Money Watch by Amy Peachy, which was substantive. And there were, as I say, a few other pieces. But really, if people heard about this story, they heard about it from people communicating outside of and around the corporate media. And I guess I find that both frustrating and hopeful. You have been doing the work around this set of issues for many years now. Do you see improvement or change in media's attention to the rights of the incarcerated?
I think that the issue is so dominant within the culture because there are so many people who are incarcerated, you really can't not see it. Then also internationally, we're so out of step. I mean, it's really unprecedented worldwide, the kind of incarceration that we have. Nobody else does it this way. And also, in the past 30 to 40 years, we've experienced an incarceration boom. Now, in fact, many of these policies are criminogenic. They create crime. So it's really a vicious cycle that we have to get out of. And I think what we need more of is we need more of a bright, white, hot spotlight shined on these issues. And we have been missing that from the press because of probably the destruction of investigative newsrooms and also courageous legislators. I went to get a master's in criminal justice at Boston University because I was so distressed at the trajectory of what was happening. And in those courses, we never once studied anything outside of the U.S. It was all about fixing this broken system. And I think we have to actually look around because no one does it like this. We have more violence and we have more crime, and we have the highest per capita imprisonment population in the world. And we need a trend toward abolition. We need a trend toward restorative justice. This trend that we've been experiencing for the last 40 years has to go dramatically in the reverse for the health of the society.
The strike didn't just bubble up, of course. It was organized over a period of time. There has been written down calls to action from various groups, model legislation, as we say. It was scheduled for the 45th anniversary of the Attica uprising. We can expect to see more of this kind of action, do you think, from prisoners?
You know, where you oppress people and where there is bias and behavior that's fundamentally immoral, where there's a lack of health care, where there are people dying in infirmaries in prison, you're going to see resistance. And you're going to see people really taking steps to further their own human dignity and express themselves. So this is not going to stop. It's going to be led by the inside. People inside prison are going to lead this. And it's been going all the way across the country. I mean, it's been happening all over. We saw the hunger strikes in California. We saw strikes in Ohio. We saw strikes in Wisconsin. It is not going to stop because people will demand their freedom.
We've been speaking with Noelle Hanrahan. Noelle Hanrahan, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Wells Fargo employees illegally opened some 2 million accounts in the name of customers who didn't authorize them but were still charged with fees. Employees say the bank set aggressive goals for cross-selling its products, goals on which bonuses and jobs depend. But CEO John Stumpf tells the Wall Street Journal, quote, "there was no incentive to do bad things," close quote. Well, they say the fraud was concentrated in one division and more than 5,000 employees have been fired. But the $185 million fine from regulators is still less than the $200 million worth of stock Stumpf holds and only a little more than the retirement package given the executive in charge of the division identified as the epicenter of abuse. So how does that incentive system work again? We're joined now by former financial regulator William Black. He's associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He joins us now by phone from Vermont. Welcome back to Counterspin, Bill Black.
Thank you.
Well, Adam Davidson in The New Yorker puts it together kind of tightly just by saying, cross-selling gained Wells Fargo enormous amounts of money, as well as praise and envy from its rivals in the banking industry. The fines against the bank are just a tiny fraction of the profits they earned. The message seems quite clear. Encourage aggressive cross-selling at all costs, even if it leads to some fraud. Is there something missing there? Is there a reason that that is not a fairly good assessment of what's going on here?
We'd be lucky if it were only that, because there's no historical context given.
Right.
And the historical context is that we had just seen in the United Kingdom for at least a decade, and the number of people think it's lasted at least two decades, something that was created by the, exactly the same kind of mechanism, where you would make much more money if you cheated, and you would get potentially fired and certainly reprimanded, lose pay, if you refuse to do the wrong thing. So in the UK, what they did was cross-sell what they called payment protection insurance, and that was to regular customers. And then if you were a small business person, what they did was cross-sell a complex financial derivative, the insurance product. The bank then immediately turned around and sold and got 80 cents on the dollar immediately and transferred all the liability to another company. It involved over 50 billion pounds in the scam sales. It was the entire source of profits for British retail banking for at least a decade and maybe two decades. So this is the biggest deal in cross-selling. This is what Wells Fargo's senior executives would have known would be the inevitable result of these perverse incentives. And to state the obvious, when you're talking about over 5,000 people and the magnitude of just complete fraud with these 2 million accounts plus other credit cards in very large numbers being scammed, you know that it's not a few rotten apples. And the response of the CEO of Wells Fargo to attempt to blame this entirely on the low-level people, to blatantly lie and say there was no incentive to do this when there were powerful incentives created by him and by his senior manager, who, as you said, is going to get a golden parachute as opposed to a jail cell, is outrageous.
And to bring it to media, I find it so galling that you can have a reporter who will quote Stumpf saying there was no incentive. The same reporter will then find employees who say there absolutely was incentive. I guess what I resent is the failure not only to then go back to Stumpf and say, look, we've been talking to your employees, and they say you're not telling the truth about this, but the broader media failure to just take on board, to just integrate into the analysis, the demonstrated fact that CEOs lie. You know, when do we get to say that companies need to be not just chided, but actually checked?
Well, they need more, right? This is not the first time this has happened.
Right.
This is absolutely serial criminality from the largest, most elite financial institutions in America. And when will the reporter write, Wells Fargo, comma, a criminal enterprise, comma, did the following new crime?
Well, regulators tend to crow about fines. The $100 million exacted by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, they're presenting that as historic. But a lot of people are, I think, unsurprisingly disappointed. They had high hopes for that agency in particular. What is there to say about the role of regulators here?
Compared to the other financial regulators that more directly regulate banks, safety and soundness, it is true this, the CFPB is, you know, in the valley of the blind, the one-eyed agency is king or queen.
Right.
They are the best of a really sad lot. But as you say, it isn't simply the dollar amount. In fact, that's not the principal criticism. The principal criticism is that the agency did not require any admissions.
So no one had to admit wrongdoing.
That is correct. And no one personally was held responsible. As you said, I was a former financial regulator. I'm a white-collar criminologist. I have negotiated these kinds of things. It's really simple to get a settlement that has a seemingly large dollar amount. Because here's the incentive structures of the CEO. One, I don't go to jail. Two, I don't lose my job. Three, I don't lose any of my income getting clawed back because of the massive fraud. But four is actually, I don't want to have any of my major officers convicted because they might turn on me and testify against me. Conversely, I'm quite willing to have money in fines because they're not going to be paid by me or any of the officers. We'll all walk away rich. All the money will come from the shareholders. So this is an easy trade-off, right? If you're the CEO, I'll be happy to settle to a what sounds like a significant dollar amount. As the press coverage you read me and your listeners earlier said, it's actually not even that big compared to the gains in this case, but it sounds large to the general audience. This has been the symbol of our response to this entire crisis. No one elite is held personally responsible. They walk away wealthy.
And on that note, it feels like a terrible joke being played on, you know, I started to say banking consumers, but unless you keep it in your mattress, it's really every person who's trying to hold on to and have access to their money. It seems like a joke when politicians stand up and say, well, let's make sure this never happens again.
Well, it does, and I really strongly recommend that people view the most recent Michael Moore movie, Where Will We Invade Next?, and look at the experience of Iceland. In Iceland, the people said, we are not going to put up with this. We're going to go into the streets and demand specific changes. And in two cases since the crisis, they have caused the government of Iceland to fall within 72 hours.
We've been speaking with William Black of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His book is The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. It's out now in an updated edition. William Black, thank you for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoTalk.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hey kids, let's go out to the garage and make some new life forms. Get ready, because that's already happening. We'll talk with Pat Mooney, founder of the Etc. Group, about crazy new technology on the loose. Then well-known journalist Stephen Kotler takes us on a tour of eco-psychology in 10 easy steps. Is it a diversion for comfortable people in coffee shops, or is it the answer? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Last week's program on strange record-breaking developments in the Arctic is still waving out into the Twittersphere, still heavily downloaded. You can listen for free at soundcloud.com, Radio EcoShock, or download any of our past programs from our website at ecoshock.org. This week's climate horror story was pretty predictable. Carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have reached new levels above 404 parts per million. Just 10 years ago, when I started this show in 2006, it was big news when CO2 hit a record high of 381 parts per million. Greenhouse gases are still climbing, and they are increasing faster than ever before. Scientists used to talk about 2 parts per million added every year. Now it's over 3 parts per million for the second year in a row. From February 2015 to February 2016, CO2 levels jumped 3.76 parts per million. The rate of carbon emissions increases are not constant. There is an increase on the increase every year. Unless we go into a crash program to save ourselves, catastrophe is right around the corner. Despite the Paris Peace Agreement, government bragging, corporate propaganda, and our own pride when we walk or turn off a light switch, humanity and all the species are hurtling ever faster towards rising seas, an ocean more acid, crop-crushing droughts, and extreme weather. Some plants and animals will not be able to adapt fast enough. They will not survive. Will humans? But climate change is just one face of a revolution in human interference in natural systems. Let's look into synthetic life, a plague of new nanomaterials, and the joys of gene drives. You may be wearing clothes created with synthetic biology and eating food laced with nanotubes. A weird future has arrived without much in the way of warning labels. Our guest Pat Mooney will be your guide. Pat founded a group in 1977 looking into food, agriculture, and commodities. In 2001, it was renamed the Etc. Group, with offices in Canada, the U.S., Mexico, and the Philippines. If it's controversial, the Etc. Group probably has a report on it. Pat Mooney, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's nice to be back. Thank you.
Your latest Etc. Group newsletter has a little humor and a lot of shocking news. I'd like to go through some of it with you. Why don't we start with the scary new industry called synthetic biology? What is that, Pat?
Well, it's sometimes called extreme genetic engineering or genetic engineering on steroids. Rather than moving a gene from one species to another, which is the usual GMO strategy, what this does is allow you to actually modify the DNA of the existing germplasm, whatever, it's a plant or an animal or whatever, and make it into whatever you want. So you actually build the DNA. You don't move something from one species to another. You actually say, okay, let's just tweak the DNA as it is, the C, G, T's, and A's that we all learned about in school to make up the double helix, and we'll convert it into whatever qualities, materials that we think would be useful at the end of the day.
And can I truly go out to a store right now and buy something made from synthetic biology?
Yes, you can. You can buy vanilla. If you're in Europe, at least, you can buy vanilla that is a product of synthetic biology rather than being grown in a field in, or in a forest in Madagascar. It's being brewed in a vat in Switzerland. A number of flavor and fragrance commodities, including crops like stevia, the so-called the wonder non-sweetener kind of in soft drinks and so on, is being developed now, is also now being brewed in a vat. Many other commodities may be in the next few years. Cotton, the same way, they're looking into modifying cotton through synthetic biology. Some of the so-called biofuels that are supposed to power our cars and get rid of fossil carbons are also being developed using synthetic biology, though that doesn't seem to be working nearly as well for them.
And now we don't even need a room full of people in white coats to make these new life forms. Your Etc. Group newsletter talks about a company offering, quote, a fully robotic cloud-based biotech lab. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, now what can be done is it's possible to literally go to a field, identify a plant you might think is useful. You can sample the DNA of that plant on the spot. You can beam it up into a cloud, a big data cloud, where anyone else can download it off the internet and have its full genetic description there, and adapt that then to modify it again through synthetic biology to make it whatever commodity they want to be. So you could find a medicinal plant in the Amazon. You could put it on in the internet cloud, and then someone else could use a DNA synthesizer to adjust it to whatever way they want to make it.
All right. Now, Pat Mooney, what is going on with labeling of synthetic biology products and also with international efforts to regulate them?
Well, not much. I mean, there is movement, I'm glad to say, but it's been very, very slow. What we've got now is a major concern by some companies. Some of the major flavor and fragrance companies are concerned about this. They're not sure that this product will be well received by customers. A lot of the natural products companies want to ban it all out. Companies like Ben & Jerry's, the ice cream company, have said they won't use synthetic biology in any of their products. And we think several other companies will take the same position. Those discussions are going on right now. But there is, there's no regulation as such. It's being treated as simply a normal product. No one has to sort of do something special to get it approved for use in our food or crops or our forests or anything else.
Wow. This is the Wild West of genetic playgrounds. So your group has put out an educational video with the Heinrich Böll Foundation about this?
We have, and it's aimed at farmers. It's trying to get them to realize what the implications are if their commodities that they're growing are at risk, that they might disappear the next day, literally, or very soon because of this new challenge. But we're also trying to reach out to the Codex Alimentaire, which is the body in the United Nations organized by the World Health Organization together with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization to deal with how you do monitor and regulate natural products. We're hoping that Codex will come around and say that they don't think that this should be treated as a natural product, that it has to involve new regulations and start to work toward that. We're also working with the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, which is based in Montreal in Canada, which is does have now a working group on synthetic biology, which is an intergovernmental working group, but we're part of that group as well. And we're trying to look at, well, what regulations are required. And they're moving fairly quickly on it. There's an alarm at what's being developed. They know that this has real implications for biological diversity and survival. They know it has implications for our food system as well. So they do want to do something. We expect that by the end of this year, there'll be a meeting in Mexico of the Convention on Biological Diversity of all of the member governments, about 195 member governments, that will sit down and try to sort out what regulations are required.
All right. Now, Pat Mooney, before we get back to freaky sci-fi products now on the markets, let's relax a little in the world's forests, except that news is hardly relaxing. Apparently, satellites have been misreading the amount of the Amazon rainforest lost to agriculture. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Well, the satellites were missing large strips of the Amazon. They just weren't hitting that area, and they thought they were covering everything, and they weren't. So they're misjudging how much biological diversity there was and how much biomass there was in the Amazon by about 20-25%. They're not entirely sure how much they misjudged it by. They've also been misjudging the amount of biomass because they're finding that with climate change, the trees are growing faster, but they're not living as long. And so that means, again, that the amount of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere is probably higher than was expected. And the amount that's being stored is probably half of what was expected. And that really changes, again, our understanding of what the forest role is in protecting us from climate change. So that's kind of been a shock to the scientists doing the satellite work and to the rest of us. It's not unusual, I must say, that we've also found that over the years, you'd think with climate change there'd be more and more satellites monitoring the climate. There have actually been less and less in the last several years. They haven't been replacing the ones that have been dropping out of the sky. And the number of instruments on some of the satellites is also less than it was before. So we tend to be, I think The Economist magazine called it willful myopia, deliberately choosing not to know the bad news of what's happening with the climate.
And in other bad news I would never have known without your Etc. Group newsletter, it turns out a huge amount of deforestation is carried out by slaves. I thought slavery was over, and what are they doing with the forests?
Well, they're often the ones that are used, indentured slaves, to do the forest clearing, which is illegal. An awful lot of the forest products that we use, some argue, UNEP, UN Environment Programs argue that it's perhaps as high as 75 to 90% of all forest products, tropical forest products, are illegal. And a lot of that illegal forestry is done, again, by children and adult slaves who have no choice but to do that job. The last study that came out was at the end of last year, at the end of 2015, estimated between 35 and 39 million people are still in slavery around the world.
Let's switch to energy. A few months ago, just before the Paris talks, I broadcast a speech by UK scientist Kevin Anderson. He says there's a big lie built into the IPCC reports and the climate talks. All their plans and scenarios assume any day now we'll deploy carbon capture and storage, known as CSS. And that'll let us carrying on burning fossil fuels. Pat Mooney, what do you say about that?
Well, Kevin Anderson's quite right. He's one of the best scientists in the world on climate change, and he's been dead on over the years as he's done his predictions and projections as to what is going on. What was being said in Paris was a huge lie. It was saying that we can somehow keep the temperature below 2 degrees or even 1.5 degrees. And even though what governments are pledging to do by their own emission cuts won't get us there. Don't worry, folks. We'll take care of that through this idea of carbon capture and storage. We'll suck it out of the atmosphere after it's gone up there, or we'll catch it at the smokestack and bury it in the ground somewhere. Well, that's a nice idea. It sounds cute, but the reality is that technology doesn't exist. Even those supporting the technology don't believe they'll actually make it functional until 2050 or so. That's way too late if we keep on emitting at the way we are, at the rate we are now. But even then, many scientists believe that, frankly, it can't be done at all. The idea that you can take a gas and bury it way down somewhere in the granite of the planet somewhere and keep it there is unlikely. It'll seep back up again. So it's a myth that we can do this, and to suggest that, and this is, of course, what does happen, is that we use the idea of carbon and capture and storage as an excuse for just carrying on with business as usual. Don't worry, folks. We'll take care of it eventually. So carry on driving your SUVs. Everything's going to be fine. Well, it's not going to be fine. We're going to have a temperature rise of 3.3 to 3.6 degrees or perhaps higher by 2100 if we continue as we are now.
And that's a mess. Well, the fallback position for the fossil fuel companies and all of us who want to keep driving cars forever seems to be geoengineering. The international community has managed to stall geoengineering in the real world, except maybe for Russ George, who we talked about a few years ago. How is the dialogue going?
Well, we're losing the battle, I'm afraid. We have a United Nations agreement that geoengineering shouldn't be allowed. That's accepted in the UN. But it's a very soft agreement. It's not, it doesn't have the weight of a police force behind it, so governments can go ahead and do what they want to if they want to, finally. And what we are doing with the Paris kind of decisions is we're getting trapped into a situation where around 2035 or so, we will have actually used all of the carbon dioxide we can possibly put into the atmosphere for this century. And we still have 65 years to go. At that stage, without carbon capture and storage, and we will not have carbon capture and storage, then governments will look around and say, well, we have no choice but to manipulate the planet. We have no choice but to do something called solar radiation management, where we blow sulfates into the stratosphere, a bit like an artificial volcano, and we block just enough of the sunlight to keep the temperature lower, so we can artificially drop it by 2 degrees or 3 degrees if we feel the need to do that. What's very attractive about solar radiation management or geoengineering is that it kind of works. It's pretty cheap. At least the direct costs are pretty cheap, not the indirect costs. And it can be done without the United Nations. It can be done by a single government or a coalition of the willing, maybe of Russia or China or the United States together, saying they'll do it on behalf of everybody else. So they will take control of the planetary thermostat. They'll manipulate the temperature themselves for the rest of us. And that's a pretty scary thought, that they would even contemplate doing that. We're backing ourselves into a corner where that's going to be hard to get out of. We're getting major governments, the German government, the American government, the Russians, the Chinese, the UK, all sort of quietly doing their own studies, issuing their own scientific reports, and they're public, many of them, saying that we have to test this model out. We have to see if we can block sunlight, if we can sort of postpone at least climate change. All of the computer studies that have been done, the simulations by computers of how you'd model solar radiation management, show that it is possible to reduce the damage in the northern temperate zones, depending on how you do it exactly. But if you do that, so you make it a bit safer for us in Canada, the United States, and northern Europe and so on, Central Europe even, if you do that, you actually devastate northern South America, sub-Saharan Africa, and possibly, the models vary a bit, possibly South Asia as well. So the majority of the world's population would be disadvantaged, but our part of the world might do a little bit better than it would otherwise.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Pat Mooney. He's the executive director of the Etc. Group. We're talking about wild developments in technology. And here's another idea that can't go wrong. Do-it-yourself gene splicing. Pat Mooney, please tell me that's not happening for commercial products.
Oh, yes, it is. Not much is commercial at this stage, but it's a bit of a strange thing. It's like probably looked at 3D printing, the idea that you can sort of print your own fridge gadgets and so on, or, you know, magnets and so on by a little desktop kind of printer that like a normal printer that you have with your computer. It goes back and forth and it builds up black ink, and you've got your printed page. Well, you can do the same thing building parts. And now, well, that's been done now for the last several years in terms of building fridge magnets. Now it's possible to actually build DNA. And so we're seeing people buy for perhaps $400. They can go to eBay and get themselves a secondhand gene synthesizer. The synthesizer is about the size of a printer. You put it on your desk. You've got four tubes stuck into it for the A, C, G, and T of DNA. You use your laptop to design the material that you want, and you build it. And you've got yourself perhaps a fluorescent plant, or you've got, which may not live or survive, but you can kind of do it. Or you can put together some unique, again, some unique genetic material that may well live and do something. A microbe or something might be built that way. That's being done now. There are fluorescent plants out there, fluorescent cats as well, I think, for that matter, and rabbits. They've been built this way. They don't live, but they are doing it. And it means an individual can do it, not just a company or a quack scientist, but actually just kids playing around can build some of this stuff. We think it's, of course, dangerous. It's 99.9% of the time, or even more, or even less, actually, this material will not work. It won't be a threat to anybody. But perhaps 0.001% of the time, they could escape into nature and cause real devastation.
Yes, fluorescent cats take over the world. I'm looking forward to that. Now, in your newsletter, you talk about a technology I'd never heard of, and the initials of it are CRISPR, Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. What the heck is that, and why should we care?
Well, it's an upgrading of what we think of as biotechnology or genetically modified organisms. Again, it's the ability to move a lot of DNA around very simply and easily. The problem with genetically modified crops, for example, is it's very, very expensive. It costs $136 million to develop a new plant variety that's genetically modified. So that's not cheap. With this CRISPR technology, you can perhaps cut that down to a small fraction of that cost, and you could actually make much greater modifications to the DNA of a plant or an animal than you could other, or a human for that matter, than you could otherwise. Attached to the CRISPR technology is something called gene drivers, where you can actually take a trait. Normally, if a plant or humans have a genetic propensity of some kind that doesn't really advantage us as people or the plant, it ceases to exist. It gets wiped out over time because there's no advantage to maintaining that negative genetic trait in your system. But with gene drivers, you can take a negative trait and you can make it a dominant gene. So it really spreads like wildfire throughout mosquitoes, for example, or throughout plants. You can go from being almost nothing to being prevalent in a crop or in a field or in a forest. And that's what's happening with this CRISPR technology together with gene drivers, is that you can take, a pest-resistant plant of some kind, and you can take that trait and you can put it, so make it ubiquitous in nature so that everyone's got that same trait in it very, very quickly. You can take a mosquito that gives you malaria, and you can embed in that mosquito a trait that makes it causes it to die quite quickly, or so they can't reproduce, and that can spread throughout the entire mosquito population of at least that species, which can sound good. It can sound like that's a real benefit to us. You get rid of mosquito and malaria that way in theory. But, of course, once you let out a trait like that, which is negative to the species, what if it spreads to other species? What if the mosquito bites something else that then gets that trait? And then we lose that diversity as well. So we just don't know where the technology will finally take us. It's rather than having a pesticide in the field that kills off some pests, you're actually letting that pesticide run, jump the fence and run into the forest and cause damage in the forest as well. We're quite worried about what that will do for biological diversity in the planet and how rapidly very negative traits might spread in populations.
Okay. You've just scared the pants off me when I'm thinking about where that could go. Moving on, another buzzword a few years ago was nanotech. How is that coming along?
Well, as far as we know, more than 3,000 consumer products in the marketplace today that use nanotech. They range from everything from clothing to tennis rackets to parts of your car and your computer to packaging for food products to pesticides in crop spraying. It's almost everywhere. It's still, again, almost entirely unregulated. Well, that is changing. We first warned about this in 2001, saying that it could be dangerous. We called for a moratorium on nanotechnology in 2003, and that was ignored. Now we got, even like last week, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris, the rich countries club, said that this is really dangerous and that there's got to be sort of emergency moves to sort of regulate this because it can be quite dangerous in nature. When you deal with nanoparticles, nanomaterials, you're talking about materials that could be 1/1,000,000th of a meter in size, I mean, extraordinarily small, 1/80,000th of the width of a human hair, you know, 8 or 10 atoms wide. And material of that size, what's special about it is perhaps two things. One is, of course, your immune system can't even tell it's there. So when you have molecules of this material, it can actually get into your blood system. It can get into your organs. It can cross through the blood-brain barrier. It can pass through the placenta, and your body doesn't know it. So that can be a real threat to us when that happens. The other element that's important in nanotechnology is that the materials, carbon, for example, or graphite, can change in their qualities as you get smaller in size. I've got a wedding ring on that's, I'm told, is made of gold. It's totally benign, very safe. People have gold teeth and so on. They're safe for life. It doesn't cause them any problems. Get down to the nanoscale, and that gold that's so benign can become reactive. It can be chemically reactive. It can actually explode. Its colors change. Its conductivity for electricity changes. Everything about it changes. And at the nanoscale, because the surface area becomes so much greater, in a sense, it's exposed to the world, you get these really strange, weird characteristics that we don't know how they're going to perform until they're actually out there being used. Now we have, again, something close to probably 4,000 products in the marketplace, including sunscreens and so on, that I think potentially can be quite dangerous. And finally now, 15 years after the initial warnings went out, we've got governments saying, hey, we have a problem here, we better look into it.
And at the bottom of all of what we're talking about here, the Et Cetera Group is working with the United Nations to set up a group to oversee and possibly control technology. I'm pretty pessimistic that we really can. It seems like just what you've been talking about, 3D printing and computers and complex ideas could come out of somebody's basement or the jungle. Can we control technology?
I think we can control the environment around it, and we can do a lot toward that. I'm not putting a lot of faith in the United Nations to do this. The UN has made some moves in the last 12 months or so, which we think are encouraging for that. But what we are creating in that is a forum for debate. The UN has not had any capacity to even talk about technologies, really, in a broad, sweeping kind of way until now. And so at least now governments will get together on an annual basis. They'll do it in June this year in New York and talk about what's going on out there with technologies. What do we need to be watching for? What's on the horizon? Should we be thinking in advance about what has to be done about this? And that, I think, is at least helpful to do. What's more important, perhaps, than just having the UN talk about it is that our partners in civil society, including farmers' organizations, trade unions, unions of concerned scientists, many academic groups as well, are coming together and saying, well, independent of what governments are talking about, what governments are doing, we're going to talk to each other about this. We're going to coordinate together and try to monitor at the national level and the regional level what we know is going on and provide a kind of an early warning system for governments. And what the UN is going to do is provide an early listening system. We're going to provide the early warning system. And we hope that together, at least, we have some capacity to be aware of what's coming down the track. And I think we should be aware that if we look back over the years, civil society has been fairly good at identifying what's coming and how that what's coming could have implications for it, good or bad, for our economy, for our environment, and so on. So I think, you know, there is that capacity there. We just haven't had anyone paying attention to it. So maybe now we'll move towards at least having people pay at least a bit of attention to it.
Well, we're starting to run out of time. We're not going to get to Terminator seeds or blockchain technology. We'll have to leave that to our listeners to Google, or maybe another time we can talk about that. I just want to ask you, back in the 1970s when you started working on issues, did you ever dream you'd experience such a wild tech ride marching into the natural world?
No, not at all. No. It took us completely by surprise. We were looking at small things that were happening to seeds, which were small enough in the first place, and concerned about biotechnology. And then we discovered that all these other things that were going on. And again, some of them potentially could be quite encouraging and positive. A lot of them, however, need a lot more thinking. And unless governments are prepared to address them and think about them carefully, what could be a good technology will be a bad technology. And that's really sad because we need good technology.
Our guest, Pat Mooney, is the executive director of the international civil society organization, the Etc. Group, based in Montreal, Canada, with branches in other countries and co-conspirators all over the world, I'm sure. You can find links to the stories, sources, and reports we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. And please keep up with the latest developments at the website, etcgroup.org. That's etcgroup.org. Pat Mooney, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock, the world's weekly journey into the big future. Browse our previous programs free at our website, ecoshock.org, and you can also find contact information for me there. We know the big problems threatening humanity and the natural world. We even have some affordable solutions. So why do we keep driving on so hard it seems like towards the cliff of extinction? Maybe it's all in the mind. In this program, we'll add to my short list of interviews on eco-psychology. Stephen Kotler is one of those endangered species called a real journalist. He's been published in the New York Times Magazine, Wired, and much more. His best-selling 2012 book, co-authored with Peter Diamandis, is Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. From New Mexico, Stephen Kotler, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, I have to admit, I think the future is much worse than you think, but maybe that's my damaged mindset. So let's talk about the really fine article you published in Orion Magazine, Eco-Psychology in 10 Easy Lessons. First of all, Stephen, why did you go bushwhacking in southern Chile, in Patagonia, in fact?
Well, one of the foundational principles in eco-psychology is that there's a very kind of deep and fundamental connection between the human mind and the natural world. And a lot of people have pointed out that there are psychological consequences that we're not aware of for, you know, the destruction that we're imparting on the natural world. And to get really kind of up close and personal with this, you know, in the midst of so much global warming, fear and noise, I don't mean hype at all, but I mean like we're hearing it everywhere in every direction. If you care about this earth, it's coming everywhere. You know, if you're going to look at eco-destruction, I wanted to see the melting of the glaciers up close, and I wanted to sort of apply the principles of eco-psychology and kind of get up close to this absolute killing of the natural world and see what it did to my brain.
Well, you know, I had to laugh along with you, Steve, once you were lost in the cold thinking, hey, eco-psychology is just a diversion for people who are warm at home. Is the conversation about the role of our minds just a pastime for first world folks with time on our hands?
That trip, my interest in eco-psychology, I wrote a book called A Small Furry Prayer about the relationship between humans and animals. And my wife and I co-run an animal sanctuary in northern New Mexico. And A Small Furry Prayer is sort of about our experiences. And the book was very successful. It was a bestseller. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. And I went on this giant book tour and 50 cities. And the only people who came to my readings were animal lovers. Nobody, didn't matter how successful the book was, none of that mattered. It was just hardcore animal geeks were the only people showing up. And I started to notice this vast disconnect. It was like I lived in a world where there was nature and there was animals, and I saw these things on a daily basis. But a lot of the people, especially on the other side of my work where I deal with kind of technology and I'm in Silicon Valley and those things, they don't see the natural world. Even if I'm talking about dogs or the work we do here, they're not hearing me, and it's not coming in. So one of the things that I was looking at is what is the difference? Why are some people able to kind of perceive nature and to really see what's going on, and other people are completely oblivious? That's a neurological, psychological issue with, you know, huge political and social and ecological ramifications. So that was sort of what set me off there in the first place.
And I was really interested in how you tied in James Lovelock's Gaia theory and then how that was brought into eco-psychology by the late Paul Shepard. Can you talk to us about that, Stephen?
So James Lovelock with Gaia, right, figured out that the Earth is potentially a giant living cybernetic feedback system, right, a sort of a living organism. And what Paul Shepard, who's just was a brilliant, brilliant mind, brilliant ecologist, kind of realized that if this was true, right, if the Earth actually is a giant cybernetic feedback organism, and you can argue Gaia in all different directions, but there are certainly, you know, there's certainly a lot of interesting proof in the direction that it's a legit theory at this point. And Shepard said, hey, if this is legit, then if we're one giant living organism, then there are direct connections between the natural world and the human mind. And the great, and this isn't his, James Serpel also kind of poked at this idea. A lot of people have poked at it, but what Paul Shepard kind of pointed out is that, for example, we didn't grow up thinking of animals as other. We actually grew up thinking in animals. They were our first metaphor. They're still the metaphor we reach for. He's as hungry as a wolf. The terminology goes on and on. But he literally, his argument is we learn to think in animals. We learn to think in nature. It was our first kind of comparisons, our first grounds for comparisons. It's how we learn to navigate the natural world, and these sort of deep structures, to use Claude Lévi-Strauss's word, are sort of embedded in our brain. So his argument is that we are experiencing kind of the death of the natural world at a really deep fundamental level that goes in so far and so primal and so kind of baked into our evolution that we don't notice the massive damage it's doing.
Well, this idea that damage to nature is also damaging our own mental health is gaining more ground. There was a U.S. National Wildlife Federation report on it in 2012 with experts, and I just saw an article about it in a major Canadian newspaper February 28th.
Yeah, absolutely. Eco-psychology, it's not a new field. It's been around for 30, 40 years at this point. I'm thinking Theodore Roszak coined the term, I think, in the 70s, maybe in the 80s. But so the ideas have been around, they've been percolating a while, and you know, there is all kinds of very, very, very real science, both on the cause, like we understand some of the neurobiology of what we're talking about here, as well as the effect side. So for sure, I mean, eco-psychology is why they have found that a 20-minute walk in the woods outperforms all the ADHD medicines on the market. We have a deep psychological relationship to nature, and if you want to calm down the brain, walking in natural spaces is more effective than the best drugs we have. And there's study after study after study showing this.
That's true. I read about that. That's very true. Okay, now you also mentioned Laura Seawall and her essay, The Skill of Ecological Perception. I'm not familiar with that one. How does that tie in to what you were working on?
Essentially what you're talking about when you're talking about eco-psychology is awareness. And I'm going to talk about this from a neurobiological angle. So every second of every day, your senses take in a massive, massive, massive amount of information. It's been calculated somewhere between, and this is a ridiculous range, 11 million bits a second and 400 billion bits a second. Whatever it is way, way too much for the conscious mind to process. The extreme outer limit of what we can process consciously, what our working memory can hold on to at once, is essentially 2,000 bits. And it, like most of us, really can only hold on to about 120 bits at once. And to put that in context, you're listening to me talk, that is taking up 60 bits of RAM in your brain. So there's only about two people talking, and that's it. So you've got this massive amount of information coming in and a very, very reduced consciousness, very few bits of information. Now, most of your consciousness, because of how the brain is wired up and how information filters through the brain, is filled with stuff that we could possibly be afraid of for obvious evolutionary reasons. We want to survive, so we pay a lot of attention to those things that scare us. It's some significant portion of our consciousness. I've heard numbers all over the place. 70% of the stuff that gets in is one thing that I hear fairly often. It's basically stuff that that we could be afraid of. If you're talking about 2,000 bits coming in a second and 60-70% is taken up by stuff that could kill us or we're worried that could kill us, very little other information is coming through. If you don't care about the natural world, if that's not interesting to you, if you're not noticing, you literally, it will be invisible to you. And this is something, you know, we're talking about this very, very theoretically, But I spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley, a lot of time around a lot of technologists who are taking on grand global challenges, poverty, hunger, water, really significant issues. And yet they live in a world that's very technological. They sit in front of screens all day long. They very rarely get into the natural world, and they don't even see nature. So the very people, I believe, and this is sort of what we write about in Abundance a little bit, who are best suited to address some of the challenges that we're facing, they don't even see the fact that there are challenges out there because they don't see nature, because they haven't tuned their brain to appreciate it at all, so it can't come in. What Laura Sewall has done, to return back to your original question, is she has sort of broken our, what I'm terming appreciation nation. What I literally mean is the ability to see the natural world. She's come up with a five-step process with which somebody can kind of learn to see the natural world. It was a process I was playing with when I was down in Patagonia. And, you know, the funny thing about the process, as I pointed out in the article, I went down to Patagonia, and it was already an arduous trip to kind of the end of the earth. But, you know, the storm of the century blew in. We had 100-mile-an-hour winds. As you read in the article, I got blown off the side of like a 30-foot waterfall and landed in shrubbery because the wind was so fierce. And, you know, it's kind of funny when you're trying to, like, deploy these five steps towards ecological perception, you know, so you can see the natural world at a very point that, like, the natural world is doing nothing but kicking your butt.
Well, you know, if human intelligence was developed over a very long time as hunter-gatherers, is it really any wonder we've become so crazy living in these concrete boxes looking at screens where nature's more or less banned, just as you said?
Yeah, there's certainly no way around it. Everything we know about evolution teaches us that these things are going to be encoded pretty, pretty deep, and to deny ourselves access to it is just, it's significant. And, you know, there's massive mental health concerns. We know being out in the natural world is something that lifts depression. Same reasons, right? Like, we're wired this way. We need that contact. I'll give you a crazy, totally separate thing that nobody actually in the world knows exists, but I run a dog sanctuary, and part of our healing methodology is to create an environment, because we work with very, very sick animals, is to create an environment using evolutionary psychology that's very, very similar to an environment that dogs evolved in. So dogs evolved in small groups of humans, big groups of dogs, and they all den together, right? Like, we slept with dogs. That was one of the reasons we cohabitated with them. The phrase three-dog night is literally a night so cold that you need three dogs in the bed to survive, right? It's even coded into our language. So here's something that interesting. This is eco-psychology in action. Dogs have better senses of hearing and better senses of smell than humans. So when you cohabitate with dogs, and this is what we evolved to do, so everybody's hardwired to do what I'm about to explain. What happens is, after a little while of kind of sharing your bed with a bunch of dogs, this big pack, is you start outsourcing safety and security. So you have a hyper-vigilant response in your brain every second. It's kind of screening for danger, right? But dogs smell better. They hear better. They're better danger detectors. So the process naturally, just by cohabitating with dogs, gets outsourced. So when I go, I do a lot of public speaking, I do a lot of traveling, I'm on the road. The second day I'm in a motel, my body will start to realize I'm not surrounded by dogs, and my vigilant centers will turn back on. And for that entire second night I'm in a hotel, I won't sleep because every sound wakes me up, because I'm not hardwired to actually deal with it. I co-evolved with dogs. I'm hardwired to outsource that to them and let them deal with it. And when that goes away, raises my stress response. I lose sleep.
Do you find yourself longing for the apocalypse? I did. I was looking for a reason to live. Hi. Are you feeling tired, irritable, stressed out? Well, you might consider nature.
From the people that brought you Getting Outside comes prescription-strength Nature, a non-harmful medication shown to relieve the crippling symptoms of modern life.
Nature's recommended for humans of all ages, and it's great for pets, too.
Nature can reduce cynicism, meaninglessness, anal retentiveness, and murderous rage. In clinical studies, Nature is proven to decrease work-induced catatonia.
Caution. Nature may cause you to slow down, quit your job, or seriously consider what the f*** you're doing with your life.
If you are overly cynical, jaded, or emotionally numb, you may need to increase your dose.
Do you find yourself longing for the apocalypse? I did. I was looking for a reason to live. Hi. Are you feeling tired, irritable, stressed out? Well, you might consider nature.
From the people that brought you Getting Outside comes prescription-strength Nature, a non-harmful medication shown to relieve the crippling symptoms of modern life.
Nature's recommended for humans of all ages, and it's great for pets, too.
Nature can reduce cynicism, meaninglessness, anal retentiveness, and murderous rage. In clinical studies, nature is proven to decrease work-induced catatonia.
Caution. Nature may cause you to slow down, quit your job, or seriously consider what the f*** you're doing with your life.
If you are overly cynical, jaded, or emotionally numb, you may need to increase your dose of nature. Do you have trouble being even mildly uncomfortable? Nature may not be right for you. Side effects may include spontaneous euphoria, taking yourself less seriously, and being in a good mood for no apparent reason.
So ask your doctor if nature is right for you.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, talking with the best-selling author and journalist Stephen Kotler about the prizes and the perils of eco-psychology and many other things. If you'll give me a second, Steve, I'd like to read a short quote from your article, Eco-Psychology in 10 Easy Lessons. After looking at the meltdown of the glacier, you were saying, once this meltdown is complete, it will not reverse. The freshly melted water will never become ice again, at least not in any time frame that is fathomable in human terms. What does it feel like to witness these end times, awful, like murder, like I'm the one who is melting? So I'm wondering if we can really, Stephen, stand the pain of recognizing ourselves in this eco-psychological mirror.
It's an interesting question. I think about this a lot because I think anybody with any kind of environmental awareness these days, you sort of have to function at all in this world, numb a huge portion of yourself, ignore a huge portion of kind of what's going on around you at all times, which, you know, I'm no expert, but I can't think it's healthy.
Yeah. You know, I've had guests who've compared our behavior in these times to the mass murders of the Holocaust in World War II. Do you think that's going too far?
You know, I think that's a very hot, touchy subject, but what, I mean, we've got species die-off rates that are 1,000 times greater than normal. The sixth great extinction, you're comparing that to a Holocaust, right? An attempt to murder a people. But if you're, you know, I'm going to get killed for this, but if you're working the numbers, I mean, we're talking about whole species, many species, going, you know, going extinct forever every year. So, you know, I know people care more about people than they do plants and animals, and they those kinds of comparisons make them very, very upset. But I always look at this question kind of neurobiologically. For a really long time, nobody kind of wanted, you know, dogs were research animals. And dogs are essentially, from an intelligence perspective, from an emotional perspective, they have the same six core emotions we do, the same social emotions we do. They're essentially four-year-old children in their IQ and vocabulary. And, you know, we do things to dogs that we would never do to four-year-old children. So people don't like it when you make those comparisons between, say, you know, the sixth great extinction and the Holocaust. But I don't think you're that far off.
Hmm. Well, given all we've talked about, what gives you the optimism about the future found in your best-selling book, Abundance?
Well, so you have to understand that what is at the core of abundance is this idea that right now, for the first time in history, because of four emerging forces, we have the possibility to significantly raise global standards of living and address many of our grand challenges. And the difficulty here is it's a race against time, right? We're either going to drive ourselves into a world of abundance, or we're going to wipe ourselves off the face of the earth. And we're not saying this is techno-utopianism. Our argument is not that this stuff happens automatically. It's that it is actually possible. We know how to even the sixth great extinction, like, this is no mystery. We've known since the 60s, essentially, how to stop the sixth great extinction. You take a bunch of land away from people, and you give it back to the plants and animals. You link up our national parks with migration corridors, and you stay out of the way. You give animals more space and more room to roam. We've known that since, you know, Michael Soule did his island biogeography work back in the 60s and 70s. It's not a mystery, right? We now have the technology that liberates that land. For example, cattle occupy one quarter of all the land on the earth. We have in vitro meat. We can grow steak from stem cells. You know, painless beef grown from stem cells in bioreactors frees up a quarter of the land on the planet. We can repurpose that land for animals. This is it's not hard, and people are doing it. In fact, the U.S. military has been doing this, you know, for 80 years. They've been setting up eco barriers and migration corridors, and, you know, they found it the most successful thing they could do to kind of fight off lawsuits from environmentalists, and it works. It brings species back. We've seen it. We've got the proof. We know how to solve this, and we have the technology, and that's just one example. I could talk about vertical farms. I could go on and on about this stuff, but we have the technology to solve these problems. Are we going to do it is an open question. And but what we are saying in abundance is, hey, wait a minute, this is actually now possible today. And we're also saying that a lot of the bad news you believe in is actually wrong. You have wrong information. And I'll just give you a couple of examples since we got in this direction. One of the things that's really, really tricky is that, take poverty, for example. It's something of a moving target. If you go back 100 years ago, the richest people on the planet did not have air conditioning, a cell phone, a telephone, a television, air conditioning, a car, flushing toilets, running water for that matter. Today, people living below the poverty line, 70% of people below the poverty line have access to all those things. So we keep moving the number, but if you go by, you know, current studies at current rates of decline, by current definitions of poverty, you know, and this is studies run in The Economist by top thinkers, we're going to end poverty by our current definition in 30 years. Or if you go, you know, you want to go back in time, poverty has been reduced more in the past 50 years than any point in the previous 500. According to Steven Pinker, we are living at the most peaceful time in the history of the human race. And groceries are 13 times cheaper today than they were in the 1800s. The list goes kind of on and on about what's kind of gone on. So there's actually a ton of really great news that we don't tend to look at. And by the way, the reason we don't look at it is because our brain is dominated by looking for danger. So we notice the negative much more than the positive. And that's like, you know, established psychological and neurobiological fact. Basically, for every kind of one positive thing that gets into your brain, you'll notice 10 negative things.
That's so cool what you just said. You know, I've had this argument too with Brian Welch. He's the CEO of the company that publishes Mother Earth News, and he wrote a book, Beautiful and Abundant, Building the World We Want. And he got me thinking, is it possible that we have so much trouble partly because we lack a vision of who we want to be?
Oh, I think you hit it on the nail. I mean, I really, like, we go where we look. And what I mean that is, like, we are literally hardwired biologically to go where we look. And this is a weird example. Do you surf by any chance?
I did when I was younger.
Okay. Have you ever ridden a tube?
I never really got that good.
Okay. One of the things that happens when you're tube riding is when you pull into the wave, you make your bottom turn, and all you do is you look through the tube, because everything is happening at so high speed. So how do you surf a tube? You literally look through the tube, and your body goes where you look. Everything else sort of happens automatically. That's not just a surfing athletic phenomenon. That is how we are wired to work. I'll give you another crazy example, and this comes out of, I run the Flow Genome Project. We study ultimate human performance. So this is stuff that comes out of the other side of the work I do and studies of ultimate human performance. But in ultimate human performance, there's something called the Bannister effect, and it's really peculiar. So Roger Bannister, as you probably know, is the first guy to run the 4-minute mile. And before he did it, everybody thought it was impossible. There were New York Times op-eds written by doctors saying, look, the first person who runs a 4-minute mile is going to die at the finish line. Forget a parade. You're going to need a hearse. And it took forever to do it. I mean, if you look at mile times, they went down by like a half a second, a fraction of a second, a decade, for like 60 years. And then Bannister does it, and the next month, somebody beats his time. And a couple months after that, somebody else beats his time. And within 10 years, a teenager has beat his time. So what the hell? Right, the physical challenge running a 4-minute mile did not change. It's still a sub-4 mile. It's really physically difficult. All that changed is the mental frame we build around the challenge. This is called the Bannister effect, and what it means is there's a very, very tight correlation between psychology and performance. You have to believe something is possible before it's possible. And there are, for all the reasons we've been talking about, kind of how the brain filters information, for all the reasons that you might imagine, this is very, very true. So one of the things, you know, I often have said is if we want to solve a lot of problems, we could just start by getting the technologists and the environmentalists and the ecologists in the same room together so they see each other and hear each other and have to talk to each other. I really do believe, you know, the solutions are within our reach. But I'll give you an interesting example. In abundance, for example, one of the things that we talk about is if you want to solve the biodiversity crisis, coupling in vitro meat to vertical farms, two technologies that massively liberate land and repurposing this land for animals and plants. It's the center of the book. We talk about it in the book, and yet the book came out. It was a massive bestseller, and in the hundreds of interviews and talks and speeches and whatever I've done about the book, nobody's ever asked me about that because nobody sees nature. They see all the other stuff we wrote about feeding people and getting people water and providing freedom and health care and education, all the people-centered stuff. But the animal stuff is still a giant mystery to people. So I think the solutions are there, and it's really important to know that they're there because we're hardwired to go where we look.
Well, just as we wrap up, what is the Flow Genome Project?
We are the largest kind of open source research project in ultimate human performance. We want to decode the science of ultimate human performance, and it's called the Flow Genome Project because flow is a technical term, scientific term, for a state of optimal performance. It's a state where we feel our best and we perform our best. And more specifically, it refers to those moments, I'm sure you've experienced them yourself, of rapt attention, total absorption. You get so focused on what you're doing, everything else just vanishes. So action, awareness start to merge, time dilates, which is a fancy way of saying you don't notice that it's passing. 5 hours will go by in like 5 minutes. Your sense of self sort of disappears, self-consciousness, that voice in your head, that incessant chatter goes quiet. And performance, all aspects, go through the roof. And flow science sort of dates back about 150 years, but over the past 20 years, there's been a revolution in neurobiology. We've been able to look under the hood for the very first time, see where this state is coming from, see how it shows up, how we can get more of it. And so the Flow Genome Project is an organization of people who are dedicated to kind of decoding the science of flow, and we're training people up in it. So we're a research and a training organization, and on the training side, we work with everybody from kind of top athletes to the U.S. Special Forces to Fortune 500 companies, and we train people up in how to maximize flow and productivity and motivation and those sorts of things.
Is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to pass on to our listeners or a new project you want to tell us about?
The only thing I want to pass along is if this stuff is interesting to you, you can find me online at stephencotler.com or at theflowgenomeproject.com or on Twitter at Stephen_Kotler, which is K-O-T-L-E-R.
Well, we based this interview on Ecopsychology and 10 Easy Lessons in Orion Magazine, and I'll put a link to that on my blog at ecoshock.info. You may also be interested in Stephen Kotler's book, Tomorrowland, Our Journey from Science Fiction to Science Fact. That sounds good to me. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, my pleasure. Thank you.
Radio EcoShock reaches out to you every week from over 90 nonprofit radio stations in 4 countries and countless net stations. If you agree this program content is important, you can help, please go ahead and forward the show widely. Tweet about it. Get it on Facebook. Play it for your friends. Thank you for helping me get the word out by extending the voice of our expert guests.
Are you suffering from an existential crisis? Prescription Strength Nature may help you. Clinical studies have shown that nature can save you from your neutered existence.
Being in nature can remind you that you have a body and that you're not the center of the universe.
If you care more about selfies than preserving the natural beauty and wonder of the environment, you may need to increase your dose of nature.
Our fake ad for nature as the new pharmaceutical wonder drug was created by the folks at nature-rx.org. You can find the video version on YouTube with the link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. We'll finish up with a tune by Natalie Merchant. It's called It's a Comin'. I first saw this posted on Guy McPherson's blog, Nature Bats Last. Here are Natalie's opening words. Wildfires, dying lakes, landslides, hurricanes, apocalypse in store, nothing like ever seen before, it's a-comin'. Third-generation refugees, street mobs, burning effigies, revolution, civil war, like nothing ever seen before, it's a-comin'.
Back. It is the Tate Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I want to tell you about Mr. Hoyle and his book, just in case we're doing our best and we've got the right number. But sometimes I've had guests who sit by the phone and think, well, that's not the one. I'm waiting for my call, but they don't pick up the one that is the call. Anyway, he has written a book called Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court. And this was published in 2014. The beauty of this book, and the reason I'm calling it to your attention, I'm not asking you to go buy it. You can go to the Africa Research Center at Africa Research Center. You will find a list of books and articles. Very well done. This is high caliber stuff. Mr. Hoyle's a PhD, and he's very well qualified to do this. It's a 625 book page book. But you can download it. This is a free book. And it's kind of like that old title, Everything You Wanted to Know But Afraid to Ask. It's in the book. We're interested in talking about this subject because, as I say, later in the show, we're going to be talking to a member of the Women's Action for Peace in Burundi. And they're very concerned that their president is being targeted by the international court system, they can't understand why this targeting is going on. How is it possible that you have this international tribunal, the ICC? It's located in The Hague, and so far, more than $1 billion have been spent since it was set up. More than a decade ago. And there are so far 32 indictments. Every single one of the 32 is an African. Every single one. And it's called the International Criminal Court. And boy, it is criminal. It is, and it is time to definitely take a stand. Everyone should understand. There, unfortunately, Phil, you know about this, there's a tendency. When people are angry, you know, one country against the other, I'm going to take you to the ICC. I've heard about it in the case of the Palestinians. They say, well, we're going to take the Israelis because of Gaza, take you to the ICC. No, that's not how it works. And unfortunately, people buy into the rhetoric and they use the rhetoric. They shouldn't do it because this is a bankrupt court. It's not bankrupt in that they all got plenty of money, but it is morally, ethically, legally bankrupt. And they have had people, they've had people in custody for 6 years. They were holding them. These are Africans, holding them. And then it turns out they have nothing. The case collapses. It's a disgrace. And yet, people wearing, you know, the garments of power and UN officials, whatnot, who are very well paid, by the way. There's not a one of them that doesn't make above 200 grand. All the ones you're looking at, when you know, those guys are all above 200 grand a year. That's U.S. and it can't be taxed, incidentally. For those of you who are aspiring crooks, you know, get in on the ground floor. This is where the money is. They don't pay taxes on that. I could go on and on about what that business. But you take the case of the Mr. Jomo Kenyatta. The son of Jomo Kenyatta, Uhuru, Freedom. His name is Freedom Kenyatta. He gets elected to be president of Kenya. And all of a sudden, the International Criminal Court said, oh, well, we have some charges here. And, you know, Kenya was respectful of the court. They played ball. I mean, they said, well, what are the charges? What do you want? This and that. And they put up the appropriate barriers of, you know, we are a sovereign country. We do have our own laws, and we have the people who enforce them. So that they went along. And Mr. Hoyle, in his book, points out that one of the things a prosecutor immediately wanted to do, or got permission to do, was freeze the money belonging to President Kenyatta and of other accused. Freeze it. And as Dr. Hoyle points out, there is a word, there's a kind of a concept most of us are familiar with, which is presumption of innocence. But they were going to take his money while they held him to go on with the trial. And just phenomenal. Well, speaking of things that are phenomenal, we have phenomenally reached Dr. David Hoyle, and he is the author of Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court. And you can get this at Africa Research Center. Are you there, Dr.
Hoyle? I am, yes, indeed.
Well, it's great to talk to you. I was just explaining to our listeners that we, later in the show, we're going to be talking to someone from the Women in Action for Peace in Burundi. And they are very concerned that their president is being talked about in upper echelon UN circles, but particularly people with nice titles about human rights, this or opposition to genocide committee. And they don't understand why this targeting is going on and how that mechanism works, as though there's a presumption of guilt and there's a presumption that if a report were to come down from one of these, from this commission, they could suffer further sanctions. They could suffer all kinds of problems. Could you talk about that? From your book, I'd say I don't know anybody better versed on the topic.
Well, I think your background is a very distinct one also in that respect. I think at the end of the day, it boils down to lawfare, an attempt to use things that are actually presented as instruments of law or a attempt to use mechanisms, legal mechanisms, or mm-hmm. pseudo-legal mechanisms as an instrument of politics. And this is, of course, nothing new, but it's actually something we've seen as increasingly used, especially on the African continent, I think in the last 20-odd years. And this is, I think, actually one more example of that.
Mm-hmm. This is Dr. David Hoyle. And your book, you point out some very interesting phenomenon. I guess this, and this has to do with the practically all the operations that base themselves on this, what they say, the Security Council, that money is involved here in terms of people are interested, like the Burundians that I speak to, Rwandans, others. How does the selection process work? That, for example, I'm going to take the case of the Sierra Leone and its neighbor. When they prosecuted there, it turned out that the team of prosecutors was actually all American lawyers, but not just lawyers. They came from the United States Army and Air Force, most of them. How could that happen?
Well, I think it's obviously no mistake. It's a mechanism that has been used, I think, actually not only in terms of what happened in Syria and Liberia, but also, of course, in terms of the other cases actually for the Rwanda trial. You had a so incredibly large a percentage of not just actually serving or reserve American officers, but in fact also serve American intelligence officers mm-hmm. who were actually are cropping up all through the structure of the court, and of course in some cases also as judges. So you know, it's again, you know, the simple fact is the United States, the United Nations Security Council is the world's most political body, and of course is actually dominated by the Permanent Five, and you know, obviously in over recent years and decades, you know, specifically by the United States. And these tribunals were actually in large part established or considered controlled by Washington, and as a result, you know, have been seen and can be seen as an instrument of American foreign policy. And just to reinforce that, you do have all the way through the personnel, individuals who actually, you know, were members of the American military establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there as judges, as administrators, as investigators, as researchers, and bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you point out a very important fact, and it certainly played a role in the ad hoc tribunals of Yugoslavia, Rwanda, and Sierra Leone, and elsewhere. And people forget there was a whole crop of these weeds that grew up and now are disappearing without anybody saying where whatever happened. That money could be put into the effort without the question being raised of whether or not it was parties that were would have a conflict. States can put in money to pay for these tribunals, but also individuals and other entities, and as far as I know, they're not identified.
That's exactly right. And this actually exists, I think, even to this day in terms of the...
I could buy a court if I was Soros. I could...
Well, I mean, and I think...
I suspect him, by the way.
Of speculation that may have also been the case. Even today, even in terms of the International Criminal Court and their funding, there was a bit of controversy very early on because that exact mechanism was also mooted and spoken of in terms of the funding for the ICC. So, yes, it's been one of those very stark, you know, gray areas. And as we know, I mean, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And we've actually seen this increasingly, I mean, more and more self-evident now in terms of the activities of the ICC, where you have a court which receives up to anywhere between 60 and 70% of its funding for one bloc, ultimately, which is the European Union bloc. Mm-hmm. If you add up all the EU states, their contributions actually to the ICC, it comes in at that figure or between those figures.
Yes.
And you know, it literally does control the court. Where you have funds also coming into courts from NGOs and, as you mentioned, from individuals and other states, you know, that also is a very, very questionable and very, malleable source of income.
I have to tell you, David, I laughed out loud. I was reading your book today, some of it, and at one point when they acknowledged, United Nations acknowledged that there were this independent individuals could give them money, they said that they had to give a statement that they weren't trying to influence anybody.
Well, I'm sure that works.
If you do that, you know, in broad daylight, Actually, you wouldn't even be a very good con man. People say, well, actually, your trickery isn't that great. I mean, that's not going to work.
As you will know yourself all too well, the key to any court is its independence. If your court is in any way seen not to be independent or to be tied to funding or to politics or to party or to a state, that then eats like acid into the credibility of that institution. And this is exactly where we are with a number of these international tribunals, and also with the ICC as we speak. Mm-hmm. In fact, in terms of the ICC, there's a very similar mechanism into the independent criminal court our tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, which of course are those mechanisms that are specifically controlled by the UN Security Council. In terms of the ICC, they actually give the UN Security Council special prosecutorial rights of referral and deferral. So, the ICC, just like these other courts, just like these other international criminal tribunals, is not independent. It actually affords special rights to the world's most political entity, the UN Security Council.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book documents that the money comes from primarily the European Union, and of course, no European is charged with anything. Only Africans are charged. And I want to link this to this again, once again, to this matter. One of the most visible members of the UN is Samantha Powers, who wrote the book and all this, and a big advocate of these tribunals. Now, she's gone out of her way to visit Burundi and try to browbeat the president. And now we're getting this special report being written, which sounds like, basically a policeman putting you on notice that he intends to use some kind of coercion against you. Now, the question is, how does U.S. get its way? China has shown itself as a member of the Security Council very sensitive on the issue of national sovereignty and tends to abstain and that sort of thing. Nonetheless, though, the personnel are pretty much American appointees or people that they're very comfortable with. Do you see any changing? Because we do seem to be in a new mode here with Mr. Putin now being one who they say is not willing to go along and therefore he's an evil person. Is this exercise of running things through the Security Council and then bullying and trying to cause regime change, is that, do you detect any change in the climate?
I think I do, and I date it back to the Libyan intervention in 2011. I mean, exactly as you've said, I think, certainly before 2011, the Russians and Chinese were, sort of willing to take a back seat on most issues linked into certain aspects of the work of the UN Security Council. But as you know, to justify the Western military intervention in Libya, the Americans and the Europeans went through a process of getting certain resolutions passed through the UN Security Council. And, of course, a part of that was the concept of a no-fly zone. And it is linked into, of course, indictments or a referral of events in Libya to the ICC. And the ICC responded in super fast time. I mean, normally, to move actually from an investigation or a referral stage to investigation to indictments can take up to 3 or 4 years. In the case of Libya, the ICC very conveniently moved within a matter of weeks.
Yes.
I think it was actually about days, really.
They found Viagra in a matter of 24 hours, I think.
That's right. I mean, it was actually quite extraordinary. And what they did in effect was they actually provided the indictments and NATO provided the war. And the no-fly zone, as you know, grew to a no-drive, no no movement, no military zone at all. So NATO basically approved that arbitrarily to justify actually literally destroying every single Libyan military institution or formation they could actually identify. And that, of course, ultimately won the war actually for the NATO forces and the Islamist militias, of course, who they were actually acting as the Air Force for. Now,
yes, a Canadian military officer said, "We are Al Qaeda's Air Force."
That's exactly what it was, and I mean that's one of the law of unintended consequences, which is NATO amazingly actually provided exactly that service for militias that would subsequently morph into ISIS, militias that were actually in effect Al Qaeda militias, even then back in 2011. But come the issue, of course, that in Syria, where the UN Security Council was also invoked, or there were attempts to invoke the UN Security Council to do exactly this as well. You know, for example, referrals actually to the ICC as a precursor to NATO military intervention in Syria. The Russians and the Chinese had learned, they actually learned the lesson of 2011 in Libya. And that's why they have actually blocked every single attempt to utilize the UN as a weapon of war on the part of the West or the part of NATO in Syria. Of course, people now say, well, why are the Russians actually doing this? Well, because ultimately the Russians have seen how that mechanism has been abused and the consequences of that abuse in 2011 onwards.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they remembered what the Charter of the UN was about.
That's right. Absolutely right.
David Hoyle, it's been great talking to you. This is a wonderful book, Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court, and it is available at Africa Research Center. And it, by the way, I like the category you put it under. I think it's lawfare. Is that what it's called?
Lawfare, absolutely.
Lawfare, the use of law to make war. Lovely.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very, very much, David.
It's been a pleasure. Keep well.
Talk again. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
David Hoyle. And that was the law, International Law Court in Hoyle. We are going to take a break. We'll hear a little more of Lee Morgan and be back.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Melinda St. Louis of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses the campaign now being waged to stop a lame duck session vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Deal. Rana Epting of the group Every Voice, who summarizes the demand by 30 democracy reform groups that the moderator in the first presidential candidate debate focused the discussion on restoring faith in democratic institutions. And seven-time Grammy-winning saxophonist and composer Paul Winter, who talks about his new composition, All My Relations, a musical tribute to American Indian Movement political prisoner Leonard Peltier. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after Germany opened its doors to hundreds of thousands of refugees from war-torn Syria, Iraq, and other nations, German Chancellor Angela Merkel suffered an embarrassing defeat in her home district. In the September 4th election in the German state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, near the Polish border, the center-left Social Democratic Party finished first with 30% of the vote, followed by the anti-immigrant Alternative for Germany Party with 21%, and Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party with 19%. The symbolic defeat for Merkel raised questions about her political future after 11 years serving as chancellor. In recent months, Merkel's popularity has fallen to 45%. More than 1 million refugees entered Germany in 2015. Alternative for Germany embraces anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim positions, receiving strong support in older, declining industrial towns. The far-right Nationalist Party has developed a close relationship with the anti-immigrant Pegida movement and its new party, the Popular Party for Freedom and Direct Democracy, which views the influx of immigrants into Germany as the Islamization of the West. Across Asia, so-called special economic zones have fueled export growth and foreign investment in poor nations. But workers are heavily exploited in these zones and blocked from organizing unions. The International Labor Organization has called these zones a symptom of the race to the bottom in the global economy. Outside the capital city of Phnom Penh, a special economic zone there is a sprawling complex of factories financed by Japanese investors. The 44 Japanese companies and other Western businesses at the site include Yamaha, Coca-Cola, and the garment maker Kingmaker Footwear. According to In These Times magazine, the firing of workers for union organizing activities is officially illegal, but it is a common practice in these economic zones. Even Western corporations like Apple and Puma, with corporate codes of conduct that protect labor rights, make little difference. From the beginning, Cambodian officials tried to keep unions out of the economic zones. But that has not stopped a number of organized and wildcat labor actions that have resulted in some improvements in worker pay. However, as worker grievances grow and the corporate and government chokehold on labor organizing tightens, many predict more explosions of frustration from those trapped in the zones. In the historic U.S. Supreme Court decision, Gideon v. Wainwright, the High Court enshrined the constitutional right of indigent defendants to receive legal counsel. However, 53 years after the ruling, the Guardian newspaper reports the rights of indigent defendants is under increasing threat as incarceration rates have risen over 400% and up to 90% of those awaiting adjudication are mired in poverty. In Missouri, where public defenders are paid out of the state budget, Governor Jay Nixon, a Democrat, has repeatedly blocked legislation to cap the workload of public defenders. The governor has also vetoed a bill allocating funds to hire more public defenders, even as workloads have increased over 12% since 2014. In Kentucky, where the state Senate has blocked new funding, public defenders take on an average of 448 cases annually, over 50% above the recommended national standard. In Utah, 62% of misdemeanor offenders have no access to counsel, and at least 35% of public defenders are overloaded with cases. Unlike any other state, Louisiana pays for its indigent defense system primarily through speeding tickets and other locally generated revenue, rather than guaranteeing funds through the budgeting process. The crisis has gotten worse with falling oil prices and new rounds of budget cuts. As a result, indigent defendants are now put on a long waiting list to see a public defender. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After the full text of the proposed 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Deal was released by the Obama administration in November, a broad coalition of opponents, including labor, environmental, and consumer groups, asserted that the actual provisions in the pact were worse than originally feared. They cited an extension of intellectual property rights in the pact that will increase the cost and reduce access to critical life-saving drugs, the offshoring of thousands of U.S. manufacturing jobs to cheaper labor markets, and the flooding of U.S. stores with unsafe and unlabeled imported food. Another divisive element in the TPP, the Investor State Dispute Settlement Regime, or ISDS, allows multinational corporations to challenge local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. These corporations can then demand taxpayer compensation for those lost profits. President Obama, who is strongly backing passage of the TPP, hopes to bring up the trade deal for a vote in the lame duck session of Congress after the national election on November 8th, but before the new Congress and president are sworn into office in January 2017. But as things now stand, that may be difficult, as GOP Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced recently that he wouldn't schedule a vote on the TPP agreement this year. Your reporter spoke with Public Citizens International Campaigns Director Melinda St. Louis, who discusses the organizing being done across the U.S. to stop a lame duck session vote on the controversial free trade deal.
At the heart of the TPP are new rights for thousands of corporations to be able to sue the United States government, not in our courts, but before a panel of three corporate lawyers that can award unlimited sums of our taxpayer money, including for the loss of these companies' expected future profits. And all they have to do is try to convince this panel of three corporate lawyers that U.S. policies violate the new rights that the TPP would grant them. And that's just one piece of this massive document. They claim that it's about trade, but in fact, of the 30 chapters of the TPP, almost 6,000 pages, only six chapters deal with traditional trade issues. So we see these massive rights for corporations. We see expanded monopolies for pharmaceutical companies so they can block generic competition and keep drug prices high. We see, you know, further financial deregulation for big banks. And so for that reason, what we've seen is an unprecedented coalition of trade unions, environmental organizations, faith groups, seniors, young people, public health groups that have come together to say that this is not the model that we should be pushing and locking ourselves into for perpetuity, because you can't change these agreements after they're locked in. And so there is massive opposition to this, and it has translated into opposition from both from the presidential candidates on the from the Democratic side and the Republican side. And the elite consensus that's been pushing this free trade model has really crumbled.
Well, Melinda, tell us, what's the status of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right now? I think many listeners will have heard stories about how President Obama is still pushing hard for passage in the House and Senate. And I think the latest plan, it sounds like it's running into some obstacles, but the latest plan we were hearing about was that there was going to be an attempt to hold a vote after the presidential election and before the new Congress takes office in January. And that's called the lame duck session.
So the TPP, because it has been so unpopular, and because actually the negotiations took many years longer to complete than what they were hoping, because other countries were actually standing up to some of the most egregious overreach, corporate overreach that was being pushed in the TPP. But because of that, the TPP debate got pushed into the presidential election cycle, which helped those of us who have been wanting to put a spotlight on the secretive agreement for years so that the public could actually have a public debate. And so that has started to happen. And what that's meant is that it's become more and more unpopular. And now we're at the situation where no member of Congress wants to touch this, wants to take this kind of controversial vote. So President Obama is pushing very hard and sees the only opportunity in the very unaccountable period after the elections, but before the next Congress starts. So the recently fired or retired members of Congress come back and they have one more chance to vote when they're not accountable to the voters. So that's a dangerous period. And that's the only window that the pro-TPP forces, which are the big companies that have been pushing for this, see as an opportunity. So the good news is that because of all the massive opposition, they do not have the votes to pass the TPP. And this is both Republicans and Democrats are not supporting this, while the Republican leadership collaborated with the White House to get what they call fast track authority, which means that the TPP will only be voted up or down. There's no amendments. There's no way to fix it. So now activists and what citizens groups are pushing all over the country is to get every member of the House of Representatives on record before the election to say, where do you stand? Will you oppose a vote on this TPP before or after the election? Because we need to hold their feet to the fire while they're campaigning. And many of them are campaigning against the TPP because they know that this is extremely unpopular because it's so harmful to their constituents. You know, everybody will be touched by this. It affects our food safety. It creates more income inequality in the United States, pitting workers in the United States against workers in Vietnam who earn 65 cents an hour, rolling back Wall Street reforms, and as I mentioned, jacking up the cost of medicines and corporate rights that are at the center that allow corporations to be able to sue over our public interest laws. And the TPP would overnight double the number of corporations that could use this extreme mechanism of corporate power against our state laws, our local laws, and our federal laws. And it's extremely dangerous. And for that reason, citizens need to be contacting their member of Congress now and get them on a record now saying they will not support this expansion of corporate power in the TPP.
That was Melinda St. Louis, International Campaigns Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. For more analysis and commentary on growing public opposition to free trade policies, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. More than 30 democracy reform groups across the U.S. are calling on the moderator in the first presidential candidates debate on September 26th, NBC's Lester Holt, to require Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump to talk about how they plan to make our democracy work for all Americans. The campaign dubbed First Debate Democracy, supported by groups including Common Cause, People for the American Way, MoveOn.org, and Demos, is now collecting petition signatures that will be delivered to Holt, the NBC Nightly News anchor. Those backing the campaign are urging Holt to pose pointed questions to the candidates on the corrupting influence of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. politics, a situation made worse by the 2010 Citizens United Supreme Court decision, as well as the attempt in many states to suppress the right to vote in targeted communities of color. Your reporter spoke with Rana Epting, chief of staff with the group Every Voice, who explains the goal of the campaign and why she believes the presidential candidates should discuss their views on the widely held perception across the U.S. that the structure and mechanics of America's democracy are broken and in urgent need of repair and reform.
For anybody who watched the primary presidential debate, you know that the moderators barely scratched the surface when it came to our presidential candidates and where they stand on one of the most important issues to the American people, which is, you know, our democracy and whether our voice matters in our elections and in our government. The moderators never pressed the candidates to really talk about where they stand on how they're going to restore the integrity to this system, this government that's supposed to be of, by, and for the people, but throughout the years, you know, we've gotten further and further away from that. And so the American people are, you know, we believe enough is enough. This campaign season, we really need to press the presidential candidates as we head into the general election about what are they going to do to strengthen our democratic system. And so we're calling on Lester Holt, as you mentioned. He is the first moderator of the debate. The first general election presidential debate is on September 26th, and he has the ability to decide what the issues are that the candidates will be asked about. So we're saying, first, the candidates must debate democracy, and that's the name of the campaign, First Debate Democracy. And yes, over 30 organizations, not just democracy organizations, but organizations like Sierra Club and the NAACP and the Agenda Project and Franciscan Action Network. So folks that don't just focus on democracy, but focus on other issues that matter to the American people are saying, we need our candidates to speak to this, and we need our candidates to lead, to say, this is how we're going to create a better system for all of us. And so far, the campaign, the election season has not challenged the candidates to speak to this. And we've had enough, and we need to prioritize this heading into the debates starting at the end of the month.
Rhonda, what do public opinion polls tell us about what Americans are thinking as regards to our democratic infrastructure, our democratic system, money in politics, the mechanics of voting, and a lot of other related issues?
Well, although this election season has been pretty partisan and people have picked sides, I would say around the issues of money in politics and our democracy, there is a fair amount of unity. So you've got about 85% of Americans, Democrats, Republicans, independents alike, believe that we need fundamental changes to our campaign finance system or to completely overhaul it. And then you've got 3/4 of Americans believing that our government is corrupt. So we definitely, the vast majority of us agree there's a problem. The difference is when you get to the solutions. So Democrats, Republicans, it's not partisan. We all agree that Citizens United needs to be overturned. There's vast agreement and support for small donor public financing, which is the way where you can fund campaigns or really lift up the voices of regular people. 72% of Americans support small donor public financing. But then where you see the divergence is when you look at the party. So the GOP, really, when you look at, the GOP presidential nominee, and when you look at the rank and file GOP leadership in Congress, that's really where you have the gridlock. No candidate in the presidential primaries on the right had any platform of how they would restore integrity to our democracy. And we know that Senator Mitch McConnell is really holding up any movement in this in the Senate and basically has told rank and file Republicans, you will not vote on any democracy issues, period. So you're seeing gridlock in the places where people hold power and don't want to get rid of it. But in terms of the people and folks listening to this program and your neighbors, there is broad agreement that change is needed.
What kind of answers would you like to see from the candidates if Lester Holt decides to pursue the question of a really big issue in campaign finance? And that's the vow of at least one candidate, Hillary Clinton, to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which opened the floodgates wide to unaccountable and unlimited amounts of money flowing into election campaigns.
They're really different on both sides of the aisle. So for Donald Trump, he's not put out a plan to address the so-called rigged system, he says, exists. And so we really want to know, well, how is he going to fix it? Instead of just complaining about it, what are you going to do to restore integrity to it? And so we really have no idea where he stands. Now, on the other side, as far as Hillary Clinton, Hillary has a really robust campaign finance reform plan. You should go to her website and look at it. And in terms of the reform community, we're pretty happy with where she is on paper. We wish that she would talk about more the solutions that she's going to advocate for. We want to hear from her. How is she going to work from Congress to overturn Citizens United? What litmus test will she use to nominate Supreme Court justices? How will she work with Congress to implement small donor public financing systems at the federal level? How will she support the good work in the states that several campaigns are being run in order to change the way campaigns are financed there? And how will she ensure that voting rights is restored for millions of Americans?
That was Rhonda Epting, chief of staff for the group Every Voice. Learn more about the First Debate Democracy campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Injustices against Native Americans are the focus of attention today, with the ongoing protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. And a decades-old travesty of justice is in the news again, as activists are working to convince President Obama to grant executive clemency to the American Indian Movement's longtime political prisoner, Leonard Peltier, who has been incarcerated for the past 41 years. Peltier was convicted of killing two FBI agents on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975, during a time of extreme state repression, and sentenced to two life terms. He was convicted despite the fact that there was no evidence tying him to the crime, and his trial was riddled with lies, inconsistencies, withheld exculpatory evidence, and blatant bias toward the indigenous community. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Paul Winter, a Connecticut-based musician and leader of the Paul Winter Consort, which has performed around the world, incorporating sounds of nature, such as whale songs and wolf howls, into their music. Here Winter talks about why he wrote and produced a musical tribute to Leonard Peltier as a way of engaging more people in the struggle to win his release from prison. Peltier turned 72 on September 12th and is in poor health.
I've played in numerous benefit events over the years. The most noteworthy in recent years was two Septembers ago, the Unity Festival in the Black Hills in South Dakota, which was a two-day gathering and festival to awaken awareness of the movement to get the government to give the Black Hills back to the Indians and to honor the Treaty of 1868. And it was there, really, that playing there that led me to feel that we have to do what we can with music to liberate Leonard Peltier, who has been unjustly incarcerated for 41 years.
You said that event was focused on returning the Black Hills to the Lakota, but was Leonard also a focus?
Leonard, as the preeminent political prisoner of our time, his plight is present in any event that would take place with Native Americans. That summer was the summer of the Seeger Fest in New York, honoring Pete and Toshi Seeger, and a number of us played at Lincoln Center out of doors. And during that event, which was extraordinary, Tinia Seeger, the daughter of Toshi and Pete, read a letter from Leonard Peltier to Pete, thanking him for his support over the years. And then when we played, I played our piece Wolf Eyes, at the end of which I often invite the audience to howl. And we invited them to join in a hallelujah chorus for Toshi and Pete and for a free Leonard Peltier. Peter Yarrow then invited me to come to this gathering a few weeks later in South Dakota. I played Wolf Eyes again, and people howled for Leonard. And someone sent him a video of it, and he sent me a thank you. And I came away for that feeling that somehow music can awaken awareness and soul in deeper ways than other media, all due respect to every form that people have been using to try to make the point that Leonard deserves executive clemency. My feeling was that I wanted to find a great piece of music from the Indian tradition that celebrates the spirit of the entire history of the first peoples of this continent and combine it with Wolf Eyes and the recorded chorus of 2,000 people howling for Leonard in the cathedral, which we recorded last year, and put it forth as a 13-minute ET simply to awaken involvement in this groundswell of voices urging President Obama to pardon Leonard Peltier.
Paul Winter, at the end of Bill Clinton's second term, hopes were high that he might grant executive clemency to Leonard, but that didn't happen.
At the end of Clinton's term, when it was common knowledge that he was reviewing pardons and that Leonard was on the list, The FBI picketed the White House with 200 agents, warning him not to do it. It might have been just all that the FBI had on him. Obama does not have that burden, that baggage, and certainly he's not going to do anything in this direction until after the elections. I don't see that it could have any political repercussions for him down the road. And my point is, this is about something vastly bigger than the pardoning of one political prisoner. It's about atonement for genocide, the atonement for our government's horrible history of genocide against the Indians over the centuries. It would be a tremendous symbolic gesture for Obama to do that.
That was musician and activist Paul Winter. Find a link to his new song, All My Relations, Voices for Leonard, and more information on the campaign to grant Leonard Peltier executive clemency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Girlfriend's favorite host, hired at most on Kiss the Sky Radio, where we look at the culture, the medical benefits, the market, the environmental benefits, and the politics behind cannabis, ganja, weed, trees, turtle, and Mary Jane. So open your ears and mind while you roll up some top shelf, indulge in the world of edibles, or just sink into the show for a little bit of knowledge.
On this session of Kiss the Sky Radio, we will be talking to the prolific journalist and political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, about cannabis and how it has affected him in his life, as well as his medical condition. Stay tuned. When did you first come into contact with marijuana, and what made you try it?
I met a sister, and I think her name was Audrea. She was an older sister who first gave me a joint. You know, I was a teenager, so it did nothing for me. And, you know, it would be a while before I would, like, recognize its effect. This was the same sister, incidentally, who gave me the first copy of the Black Panther newspaper. So I thank her for both those gifts.
What made you join a pro-marijuana organization and eventually become the president?
Well, because I believe in freedom. And I enjoyed marijuana. I mean, it had really wonderful kind of psychological and physical effects. It was relaxing. It made you eat. But it also kind of liberated the mind. And this is actually, I think, before I even really began studying the Rastafarians and meeting them and talking with them. I just thought that people had the freedom to smoke what they wanted to smoke if they wanted to smoke. So, yeah. Yeah.
What kinds of things did you guys organize around?
Just generally the freedom of the ability of free people to smoke what they wanted to smoke without the state interfering with that decision. We thought, you know, that that wasn't the state's business, that if you're a free person, that's your choice to make. you know, especially if you're an adult. So we saw it at that time. There are probably more young people smoking marijuana than they were smoking cigarettes. I'm talking about the 60s, 70s.
I said, when Malcolm Shabazz and I came to see you last, you told us to stick to the green. Why is that important as a message to society? Why did you tell us that specifically?
I don't remember. Perfectly honest. I remember meeting young Malcolm, but I don't remember me saying that. So I really can't answer that with any honesty or intelligence.
A while ago, I heard your interview with the revolutionary musician and Rastafarian Bob Marley. What interested you about him, and did you guys smoke?
Yes and yes. When I arrived at that interview, it might have been, I think, the summer or the spring of 1980, shortly before he made his transition. He was in a hotel in Philadelphia, and he, before we even began taping, he produced this huge spliff. And, of course, I tasted it. I'm just lucky that I had a tape recorder going, because otherwise I probably would have forgotten that interview, too. I found him utterly remarkable. Fresh, clear, one of the most magnificent musicians ever to grace the stage. Courageous, loving of all black people and people around the world. I really covered a lot of Rastafarians who came to the city to perform. A lot of groups, but his is perhaps the most memorable, because I remember him saying something that I never thought a Rasta person would say or even believe. And his idea of unity was so profound. He said, "Move his Rasta, man. Move his Rasta." And I remember being like, damn. The fact that he would say that, it was really deep to me. And so it just told me how deep and how broad and how thick his vision was. And that's the time we spent, you know, reasoning with one another was one of the finest interviews I've ever conducted, even though I, you know, had some medicinal help. It was just magical, because he was a magical creature.
What's going on with the case around you getting medication to treat your hepatitis C? And would you use products derived from cannabis or hemp plants if they were available?
If they were available in Pennsylvania, I probably would, because they would probably relieve some of the itching. But this is Pennsylvania. Even though they passed the bill on medical marijuana, I doubt very seriously if they'll supply that to people in the jail. The judge ruled that I had sued the wrong people, as they were state officials, and I should have sued something called the Hepatitis C Committee. The problem with that is until we had our hearing, we never knew that a Hepatitis C committee existed. One of the Commonwealth witnesses really informed us about it and told us what it did. And again, we didn't know that they existed. We've never read anything about it. In fact, it was he who told us about what was referred to by us as a secret protocol. The state called it an interim protocol. They decided in this secret interim protocol that someone had esophageal varices, a fancy medical word for if you were bleeding from the throat and you couldn't process food and your kidneys and livers couldn't digest, then you would be considered to be put on the list to be treated. We learned at that hearing that out of 6,000 people who have chronic hepatitis C, the state said they only treated 5 or 6 people. It was incredible. So, you know, perhaps we should have amended right there, but we thought that, you know, that was beside the point. Anyone who promotes a protocol of death and torture, and as the judge said, a violation of the Eighth Amendment and deliberate indifference to people suffering, well, you know, that was the case. And so I am told by my lawyers that it will be amended if it hasn't been already, and we're going back into court to fight for the other half of this. Luckily, this is some daylight for 6,000 men and women who have hepatitis C and who are under the quote-unquote treatment of the DOC.
Besides the legal and all of that, how are you feeling?
You know, it waxes and wanes. I have good days and I have not so good days. And I'm sure that every day that I'm not treated, things can get worse very quickly. I would say I'm stable, I'm strong, I'm better than I was. But again, without that medication, I will only get worse. And as the judge said very clearly,
you have 1 minute left.
If you don't treat people, they'll die. So let's get it on. Thank you, brother.
Thank you. It was a long time coming. I had some other stuff, but I'll write you and we'll talk then.
Okay, buddy.
But stay good strong, man.
You were just hit with the sound waves from Kiss the Sky Radio and your girl's favorite host, Higher Than Most. If you would like to hear more from us, you can listen to archive shows at kisstheskyradio.com, also on SoundCloud and most places where podcasts are listened to. And to quote my favorite rapper, Tupac Shakur, I'm high till I die, signing off.
It has been 15 years after the plane slammed into two skyscrapers in Manhattan. Since then, the Arab world has been sent into a tailspin of violence, mayhem, and death. Much of that death was delivered by American bombs and U.S. soldiers. The U.S. invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq has unleashed a fury of hatred at the empire and created more, not less, terrorism. The dreaded Al-Qaeda has morphed into ISIS, and a score of Arab and Muslim states are but modern-day charnel houses, places dank with death. Where are things better in the Arab world? Egypt? Libya? Palestine? Wherever the Americans have set their hands, a nest of snakes have come forth, dripping with venom. Before 9/11, the late Chalmers Johnson penned the book called Blowback, covering CIA skullduggery and dirty tricks in the Middle East and beyond. After 9/11, the book took off like a rocket, for Americans wanted to learn more about 9/11, why it happened, for instance. 15 years have passed, and fewer Americans know why 9/11 happened, because Americans chose the path of war and death. An occupation and military muscle flexing, an empire. Is America safer? Is America wiser? Is America better? Over 1 million Arabs are dead today because the U.S. wanted revenge against people who had nothing to do with 9/11. So they unleashed shock and awe in Baghdad. They demolished villages and cities. They created a river of 4 million refugees. They tortured and taunted Arabs in their prisons in Iraq, Diego Garcia, Guantanamo, and black sites. They toppled leaders they didn't like. They sowed the seeds of disaster. And they wonder, why do they hate us? From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Who was responsible for the anthrax letters sent to legislators and media in the fall of 2001? What was the motive of the perpetrators, and how are they connected with the crime of 9/11? What is behind efforts by Senator Bob Graham, among others, to link the 9/11 hijackers with the Saudis? Are there specific examples of 9/11 coverage over the last 15 years that teach us about the power of media control? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we continue our special look at the 15th anniversary of 9/11 by speaking to Professor Graham McQueen of McMaster University and the co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies about the anthrax letters sent out to key individuals weeks after the 9/11 attacks. Then we speak to Professor Michel Chossudovsky about present-day efforts to link Saudi Arabia with the 9/11 hijackers. Finally, media critic Barry Zwicker returns to talk about his experiences with media suppression of 9/11 truth over the last 15 years. On this week's program, 9/11 Truth 15 Years Later, Part 2, The Anthrax Letters Blaming the Saudis and the Media Campaign. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 16th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. For all the rhetoric that we often hear about the market and large corporations offering choice to farmers and consumers, the evidence is restriction of choice and the squeezing out of competitors. Over the years, for instance, Monsanto has bought up dozens of competitors to become the largest supplier of genetically engineered seeds, with seed prices having risen dramatically. Consolidation and monopoly in any sector should be of concern to everyone, but the fact that the large agribusiness conglomerates specialize in a globalized, industrial-scale, chemical-intensive model of farming that is adversely affecting what we eat should have us very concerned. Do we want this system to be intensified even further just because their business models depend on it? That comes from the article, Monsanto and Bayer, Why Food and Agriculture Just Took a Turn for the Worse, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted September 15th. Hansen and Roberts hail from a long line of populists suspicious of the quote-unquote international institution, which they regard as something of a meddling, threatening Frankenstein. But it is Roberts who couches matters with greater meaning, adding zest to armchair paranoia. It is doubtful, for instance, whether Hansen has any serious understanding about what global institutions actually do. In truth, there is very little to be suspicious about such institutions as the UN, so bogged down in its own self-serving wishes, a bureaucratic clot incapable of actually pursuing the aspirations it has set. Changing the world as an aim through non-binding commitments is far from actually doing so. That comes from the article, Australia's Global Exit, Tribalism and International Institutions, by Dr. Binoy Campmark, posted September 15th. Dr. Omalu became famous, at least in the U.S., when Hollywood produced a film called Concussion. Actor Will Smith plays Omalu in the film, based on his discovery and how the NFL tried to silence him. Dr. Omalu is now suggesting that Hillary Clinton was possibly poisoned by either Putin or Trump. Fame can be addictive to some people. Maybe Dr. Omalu likes the spotlight, so he decided to join the mainstream media, MSM, conspiracy theory bandwagon. One of the reasons Dr. Omalu gives us is that he does not trust Putin or the Republican frontrunner Donald Trump. Here's a quote. He wasn't giving up on Twitter, adding that his reasoning is that he does not trust Russian President Vladimir Putin or Donald Trump, the Republican presidential nominee who has expressed admiration for Putin. That comes from the article, Strange Washington Post Conspiracy Theory. Renowned medical doctor claims that Putin or Trump could have poisoned Hillary Clinton, by Timothy Alexander Guzman, posted September 15th, originally appearing at Silent Crow News. The new ceasefire agreement between Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, which went into effect at noon Monday, has a new central compromise absent from the earlier ceasefire agreement that the same two men negotiated last February. The new agreement incorporates a U.S.-Russian bargain. The Syrian Air Force is prohibited from operating except under very specific circumstances, in return for U.S.-Russian military cooperation against Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, also known as Daesh, ISIS, or ISIL. That compromise could be a much stronger basis for an effective ceasefire, provided there is sufficient motivation to carry it out fully. The question, however, is whether the Obama administration is willing to do what would certainly be necessary for the agreement to establish a longer-term ceasefire at the expense of Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In return for ending the Syrian Air Force's operations, generally regarded as indiscriminate, and lifting the siege on the rebel-controlled sectors of Aleppo, the United States is supposed to ensure the end of the close military collaboration between the armed groups it supports and Al-Qaeda, and join with Russian forces in weakening Al-Qaeda. That comes from the article, Al-Qaeda's Ties to U.S.-Backed Syrian Rebels, by Gareth Porter, posted September 15th, originally appearing at Consortium News. A recent report showed that the carbon pledges made by 178 countries in Paris last December won't be nearly enough to save most tropical coral reefs and cloud forests, let alone preventing mass global extinctions. Another recent report showed that ocean slime, composed of toxic algae blooms, is rapidly spreading across Earth as a result of warming ocean waters. The toxic algae is worsening dead zones and wiping out parts of the food chain for marine life, causing collapsing populations of sea lions, seals, various bird species, and fish around the planet. Lastly, a recent report warned that we are already locked into far more planetary warming than most folks realize. Given that humans continue to inject over 30 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere annually, and the fact that what is already there has us locked into, conservatively, another 1.5 to 3 Celsius of warming in the coming decades, the new climate reality is upon us. That comes from the article, Record High Temperatures, Toxic Slime Spreads Across Oceans as Climate Disruption Continues, by Dar Jamail, posted September 14th, originally appearing at Truth Out. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. One of the aspects of the 9/11 anniversary, seldom mentioned anymore, is the follow-up episode of letters containing a weaponized form of anthrax to various media outlets and legislators. Five people died as a result, and the scare had been used, at least temporarily, to ramp up support both for the USA Patriot Act as well as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. One person who has returned our focus to the anthrax attacks is Graham McQueen. Professor Graham McQueen received his PhD in Buddhist studies from Harvard University, and it taught in the Religious Studies Department of McMaster University for 30 years. While at McMaster, he became founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, after which he helped develop the BA program in Peace Studies and oversaw the development of peace-building projects in Sri Lanka, Gaza, Croatia, and Afghanistan. Graham McQueen was a member of the organizing committee of the Toronto hearings held on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 and is co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. He is the author of the 2014 book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, published by Clarity Press, and this book will be the focus of our interview. The author joins us by Skype from Hamilton. Good afternoon, Professor McQueen.
Hello. It's good to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Could you maybe inform our listeners, what is it that caught your eye about the anthrax attacks that you sought to make it the focus of your book?
Well, first of all, I had been studying the so-called 9/11 attacks for some years. And I knew they were a fraud. And I thought, oh my God, this is really important. But now I'm hearing stuff about the anthrax attacks. I'm hearing that that the anthrax in those letters came from inside the U.S. military-industrial complex. And I had read this in other people's, you know, articles and so on. And I thought, wait a minute, if that's true, that's really important. So I thought, you know, I'm retired and I have the good fortune to be able to take time off when I want to. So I just cleared the desk and said, I'm going to look into the anthrax attacks and find out at least what the basic facts are about them. And I quickly confirmed that, yes, it's true. They were a fraud. They were blamed on Al-Qaeda and Iraq. And in fact, the spores were traced to a U.S. military lab, that is to say, a lab serving the U.S. military and intelligence communities. So I thought, as I looked further, I found something else that I hadn't known before, and that is that there was overlapping personnel in the two attacks, in the 9/11 attacks and in the anthrax attacks. Some of the same guys, namely the so-called hijackers, showed up in both. And somehow that had escaped my attention before. So then I thought, well, wait a minute, this is extremely important, because if the anthrax attacks are provably a fraud, right, if they provably came from within the U.S. military-industrial complex, and if they have the same personnel, right, the same guys involved in them as in 9/11, then this is another way of showing that the 9/11 attacks were a fraud. We've already got all kinds of ways of showing that they were a fraud, but this is an interesting angle. And it also suggests that this was one operation, not two. It was one operation with two parts. So that's when I decided to really get into it. I wrote an article, and then somebody said to me, you know, that could actually be a small book. And so one thing led to another, and it became a book.
Now, I wonder if you could just recall, both from your own research and your own recollections of 15 years ago, what were the impacts of those anthrax letters at that time, coming right on top of the 9/11 terror attacks?
Well, the truth is that if I try to put myself back to that time, I could barely remember them. You know, I mean, the anthrax attacks were pretty big news in the U.S., a little bit less in Canada. And the scare was big for a while and then quickly went away. And you see, this is part of the story. Part of the story is that once it was found out that they didn't come from Islamic extremists and all the rest of that cooked up story, there was a tendency to, well, not just a tendency, I think it was a deliberate effort on the part of the FBI and other agencies to sweep the whole thing down the memory hole. And so there are many people today, including many Americans who were adults at the time, who barely remember them. Oh, yeah, something about anthrax in the mail. You know, because it didn't turn out right, did it? I mean, you know, the story fell apart. It fell apart very rapidly. By the end of 2001, it was gone. It was in tatters. And so that really is, that turned out to be part of my mission and part of the point of the book, to remind people, but wait a minute, you know, you can't forget about these, because they could be one of the major keys to unlock the door to the global war on terror.
Yes. Now, as you pointing out in the your opening remarks, the attacks seemed aimed at people. In this instance, they seemed to be aimed at people who were in a position to expedite the passage of the Patriot Act, Tom Daschle and Leahy, through the Senate and the House of Representatives. They also served propaganda functions of linking 9/11 with Iraq. So do you have any insights into whether one or the other was the prime motive, or is it impossible to kind of separate the two as motives?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I'm always reluctant to pretend to know more than I can actually prove. What is clear is that anthrax letters were sent to two senators, as you pointed out, both Democratic senators and both after they had slowed down the passage of the Patriot Act. And this is not rocket science. I mean, Cheney said he wanted the act passed by October 5th, but it wasn't passed on October 5th because of two senators who slowed it down. Then, somewhere between October 6th and 9th, letters were put in the mail containing deadly anthrax to precisely those two senators and only those two senators, right? So it's pretty obvious that it was an attempt to intimidate them and indeed Congress more generally, which wasn't passing the Patriot Act as quick as the neoconservatives wanted them to. On the other hand, as you pointed out, there was far more going on than just intimidating Congress to pass the Patriot Act. One of the functions, I'm absolutely certain, of the anthrax attacks, just like 9/11, was to facilitate attacks on foreign nations. And by the middle of October, as you pointed out, the theory that was gaining momentum was what I call the double perpetrator hypothesis, which is that Al-Qaeda, you know, had prepared the actual letters with their misspellings and their clumsy printing and all the, you know, Allah is great, death to Israel, death to America, all that nonsense. And that, but that, you know, Al-Qaeda wasn't sophisticated enough to make this stuff, this actual physical anthrax. And so that had come from Iraq. So they managed to try and frame basically, they managed to justify the invasion of both those countries, you know, and it would have worked, except they made some big mistakes and the story fell apart.
Could you zero in on those big mistakes? I mean, you mentioned that the tracing the this particular strain of anthrax to Fort Detrick, there was clearly an intention. Well, it seems like I'm following what you put in the book, that they wanted a sophisticated state apparatus so that they could somehow pin the blame on Iraq and just thereby justify that invasion. But they used a strain that Iraq doesn't use and that's traceable to the United States. Why why did they make that? I mean, is it really that difficult to see that this isn't going to fall apart? Was it just incompetence? What are your thoughts? Why?
Again, I would need to speculate, and there are different views on that. In the small community of people who study the anthrax attacks. So, you know, my view isn't necessarily the same as everyone else's. One thing was noticeable, and that is that when it was discovered it was the Ames strain of anthrax, people did not immediately conclude that it came from the United States. In fact, there were articles in major U.S. newspapers saying that that information was not helpful in pinning it down, because the Ames strain had become so common that it was all over the world and probably wouldn't help in narrowing it down. Now, that turned out not to be true. But it may be that the perpetrators were a bit sloppy there and thought they could pass it off. The other thing is, as you know, it wasn't just the strain of the anthrax that was used that turned out to be a fingerprint. It was also the weaponization process. Microencapsulation, especially in the case of the anthrax that went to the two senators. And again, how could they have been so sloppy? Well, there was a major propaganda effort, we have to remember, in October and to some extent beyond that, to make it look like the weaponization process was Iraqi. ABC News was especially complicit in this, and they said they had four high-level, separate, you know, experts who said that there was bentonite on the anthrax spores and that only Iraq used bentonite to weaponize its anthrax. And they were really pushing that story hard. But unfortunately for them, they seem to have allowed – some scientists seem to have got into the game here who weren't supposed to be in it. In other words, some genuine scientists actually got a look at the anthrax spores, or in some cases they got a look at studies of the spores, and they kind of scratched their heads and said, there's no bentonite here. This isn't Iraqi, and it certainly isn't Al-Qaeda. This looks like our stuff. and I mean, even the armed forces, like the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, studied the spores. and put out a little report, which I have. It's quite brief, but it says, no, there's no bentonite here. So my guess is that the conspirators, and I don't mind using that term because that's what they were, who put this thing together, thought they could keep the circle fairly small and handle it. They had felt, well, we've got control of the media. We'll have ABC put out some baloney, you know, and we've got control of this and that. And so we don't need to read in all of these scientists and military people and so on who might, after all, not want to go along with this. And I think, you know, somewhere along the line, they made a huge mistake there because the whistle was blown on them to a large extent by people that you would think of as insiders.
Now, talk about they're moving on to the lone wolf perpetrator scenarios. The first, Stephen Hatfill, and then Bruce Ivins, who apparently committed death by suicide by swallowing a lot of Tylenol. Now, why did the U.S. authorities move to that particular scenario? Damage control? Did it serve any other purposes other than to, as I say, you know, just trying to move away from the failed Iraq implication there?
No, I think you've got it right. It's damage control. It's option B. It's what's sometimes called a limited hangout, where you allow certain parts of the truth to come out, but you lie, you continue to lie about essential parts. So what are you letting out? You're saying, oh gosh, it does seem this anthrax is our own. Seems like it came from our own, you know, military industrial complex. In this case, they're saying it's from Fort Detrick. And Bruce Ivins was a scientist who worked there, you know, and he had to have certain clearance and so on. And they're saying, damn it, you know, it did come from in our inside. So they're admitting it's an inside job, though they don't use the term. They're admitting it's a false flag attack that was blamed on people who didn't do it, though they don't use that term either. But what are they hiding? Well, they're hiding what's rather obvious, and I argue for it in my book, and that is that it wasn't done by any individual, whether Bruce Ivins or anyone else. Everything about this says it was done by a sophisticated, widespread network of people, just like the 9/11 attacks. And that's what they're keen on hiding. And if you can make your lone wolf, which is the term they use, into a lone nut, so much the better, which is exactly what they tried to do with Ivan. So he was on medication, he was unstable, some of which is true, but it didn't mean he was the anthrax killer. I've seen never a smidgen of convincing evidence that Ivan's had anything to do with the attacks. But, you know, stress his instability and make him more unstable. Show up at work, harass his family, say you're going to seek the death penalty, and get the guy scared out of his mind, which is what they did. Whether he actually took his life because of all this stress or whether someone just killed him as part of the operation, I frankly don't know. But either way, whether directly or indirectly, the FBI is responsible for that man's death.
Mm. And dead men tell no tales. So
Exactly. I mean, you know, they didn't have to have a trial. Like, it's hard to imagine how they could have won if it went to court. I mean, they had nothing. So as in so many of these incidents within the war on terror, the alleged perpetrator somehow dies and the court case is avoided. If you look in Canada recently, 2013, 2014, right? You find in 2013, the guys they set up, you know, John Nuttall and Amanda Carotti, actually, you know, are allowed to live. So there's a trial and the RCMP is disgraced. They're disgraced. It all falls apart. In 2014, in the attack on Parliament, the so-called terrorist takes 31 bullets, so there will be no trial.
I'm wondering, in the bit of time we have left, the efforts to link the architects of the anthrax deception with the 9/11 hijackers, with the architects of the 9/11 attacks, could you, you know, concretize that bridge for us?
Yes. Well, it's difficult to do without PowerPoint slides, but I give in my book several examples of how particular people that we know that are called the 19 hijackers. Okay, let's forget about the question for the moment as to whether they actually hijacked anything on September 11th, but they're called the hijackers. So several of them show up in the preparations for the anthrax attacks. So, for example, a woman named Gloria Irish turns out to be the real estate agent of the first man to die of anthrax. And she turns out to be the real estate agent of several of the 19 hijackers as well. Well, that's kind of weird. What are the odds of that? And as we begin to look into this, we see, for example, that the so-called leader of the hijackers, Mohammed Atta, is running around the place, making himself very visible, and trying to do things like get the U.S. Department of Agriculture to give him a crop duster plane. So that, and he says, I'm an engineer. I'm going to modify this so I can dust all these crops without having to re-land and refill. And then he threatens to cut the throat of the U.S. Department of Agriculture person who's interviewing him. And he makes all kinds of comments about Osama bin Laden. And it's, the whole scenario is so absurd, you just want to laugh. So this is obviously a guy who's, I don't know if he's really, his name is Mohammed Atta or what his name is, but he's running around acting a role, and he's laying down a trail of breadcrumbs that we're supposed to follow. And that trail is supposed to connect 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. That's its aim, because remember, Saddam Hussein was said to have to want to use crop duster planes, you know, to spread his anthrax. So suddenly there's all this stuff about crop dusters, and these hijackers are running around trying to get crop duster planes. And you see, they were successful in laying down a trail of breadcrumbs, and the press and everybody was cheerfully following the trail until the whole story fell apart.
I just want to ask you one more question, if I may, Professor McQueen. It's been almost 2 years since your book came out. I was wondering if there's, if you've seen any new revelations on the subject of the anthrax that may figure into the overall scenario with regard to 9/11.
Well, certainly. Not long after the book was published, we had a major whistleblower, Richard Lambert, who was for a time the head of the FBI's anthrax investigation, got into a serious conflict with the FBI when he left the agency and tried to get a job elsewhere, and they blackballed him. And he took them to court. And one of the things that he says, if you read it all, his document, is that one of the reasons he's being harassed is because he blew the whistle on the anthrax attacks. He says that his office was, in effect, set up to fail. He said there is, I think the term he used was, a wealth of exculpatory evidence. In other words, a whole bunch of evidence showing that Bruce Ivins, the lone nut, which the FBI still officially calls the anthrax killer, shows that he was innocent. And there's evidence there, he said, that the public has never been shown, that the FBI is still sitting on. And really, when I read his thing, I thought, well, this just confirms everything I said in the book. And I suppose if I ever bring out another edition, I'd have to discuss that.
Professor McQueen, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's been enjoyable.
We've been speaking with Professor Graham McQueen. He teaches at McMaster University in Hamilton, and the title of his 2014 book, again, is The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, and it's published by Clarity Press. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. A relatively new development in the 9/11 saga revolves around 28 pages that had been redacted from a 2002 congressional inquiry looking into the attacks. The 28 pages which had been classified are said
to detail specific financial links between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the 9/11 hijackers. Coinciding with the 28 pages, we've noticed an effort in recent months to pass legislation allowing families of 9/11 victims to sue the kingdom for damages relating to 9/11 and their supposed involvement in the attacks. A bill recently passed through the U.S. House of Representatives enabling such lawsuits to take place. Senator Bob Graham has been spearheading the effort to implicate the government of Saudi Arabia in the execution of the 9/11 attacks. What are we to make of these recent developments, and how does it alter the war on terrorism moving forward? Who benefits from the accusations against Saudi Arabia? Joining me to discuss this latest wrinkle in the 9/11 storyline is none other than Michel Chossadovsky. Professor Chossadovsky is an award-winning author, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and editor of Global Research. He joins us now from Montreal. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Chossadovsky.
Delighted to be on the program.
Now, I followed your research on 9/11, and that research seems to primarily focus on the links between Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and the U.S. intelligence apparatus. Is it possible you could just very briefly outline some of those telltale links?
Well, I started investigating 9/11 right at the outset, and at the outset, that was the... You know, that was the lead to look at al-Qaeda and the links to the CIA. But if we look at more recent findings, particularly those of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, what the conclusions are that al-Qaeda under no circumstances could have brought down the buildings. And neither could Saudi Arabia supporting these hijackers, because that is what is contained in the 28 pages. There's a very close-knit relationship between Pakistani intelligence, Saudi intelligence, and U.S. intelligence. And we know today that Saudi Arabia is supporting ISIS. Okay, so but Saudi Arabia is doing it on behalf of the United States. So that, in effect, it inserts a red herring into the debate. But the irony is that Bob Graham, and I've been following Bob Graham right from the beginning, Bob Graham makes the following assessment, which in effect contradicts his whole argument. Well, this is a quote. He said, former Senator Bob Graham, who chaired the congressional inquiry into 9/11, stated, "None of the people leading this investigation think it is credible that 19 people, most who could not speak English and did not have previous experience in the United States, could carry out such a complicated task without external assistance." Now, again, it's very contradictory, because then he says, well, Saudi Arabia is behind them. But it in effect, whether it's the CIA or whether it's Saudi Arabia was behind the terrorists, those terrorists were there to serve a propaganda purpose. Okay, because there was a whole narrative of the terrorists, of the hijackers, and so on. I don't want to get into that, but the evidence suggests that they could not have brought down the buildings, because that required a level of sophistication which they simply did not have from their flying schools in Florida and so on and so forth.
There is a term, I think Webster Tarpley uses the term patsy, and I guess that's what you're essentially saying, that these hijackers are patsies.
Well, we could call them what we want, but the thing is that right from the beginning, there was a propaganda campaign. And Bob Graham and Portagos were involved in that propaganda campaign. They were talking about state sponsors, and then they pointed to Pakistan's ISI, the money man, and so on. I don't want to get into that. But bear in mind, officially on the 12th of September, when the Atlantic Council, namely NATO's governing body, met in Brussels, they said that Afghanistan was the state sponsor of terrorism, because allegedly Osama bin Laden was being harbored by Afghanistan. They didn't actually mention the word Afghanistan. They said a foreign power, and they didn't say what it was. But then some people actually said, how come we're invading Afghanistan? You got your countries mixed up. Most of the hijackers are Saudis. And Saudi, that from day one, that statement was made. why on earth, what justifies an invasion of Afghanistan on the grounds that Afghanistan was protecting the terrorists? And there was no evidence to that effect. And in fact, the Afghan government at the time approached the U.S. State Department and said, if you have any indications that Osama bin Laden is behind these tragic events, we will deliver him to the U.S. justice system. And the response by the Bush administration, in fact, by George W. Bush, was, we do not negotiate with terrorists.
A circular argument.
In effect, Afghanistan wanted to avoid a U.S.-led invasion, which had been planned well in advance of 9/11. But then Afghanistan had been identified as a state sponsor of terrorism. So you see now, if we come back with the Saudi thing and say, oh, Saudi Arabia was behind the terrorists, this might create a little bit of political embarrassment, because then they might say, well, the Bush administration got their country screwed up, okay? They invaded Afghanistan instead of invading Saudi Arabia. But in effect, what this whole 28 pages thing is really, what it really serves is to create confusion within the 9/11 truth movement. And we can see it as somehow the controlled demolition discourse is parallel with the 28 pages. And now they want to wait, they want to those lawsuits, incidentally, against Saudi Arabia were right from the beginning. Okay? There was a lawsuit against the alleged brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden, a multi-billion dollar lawsuit on behalf of the victims. But again, we're within the realm of propaganda, and they're using this to more or less diminish the credibility of the controlled demolition thesis, which is unequivocal, by introducing something new and then saying, oh, the Saudis are behind it, we must go after the Saudis, we have lawsuits, we must invade them, whatever. And this serves essentially to create utter confusion within the 9/11 truth movement.
I'd like to back up a little.
And my response is to say, well, assuming that Saudi Arabia is responsible, they act on the orders of Washington. They always have acted on the orders of Washington.
I'd like to back up a little bit. You mentioned Mr. Senator Graham's involvement in the 9/11 saga precedes his attempts to implicate Saudi Arabia. He was very much involved in the days leading up to 9/11. Certain individuals, like the head of Pakistan's ISI, there was a meeting there. Maybe you should just outline some of the peculiar, you know, Mr. Senator Graham's peculiar involvement with regard to that.
Well, my understanding is that Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss were involved in what I would call the propaganda preparation of 9/11. In other words, they went to Pakistan in late August. Okay, I think they returned to the United States something like, but on the 28th or 30th of August, and then the head of Pakistani intelligence, whom they had met there, he arrived in New York somewhere around the 4th or 5th of September. And then on the morning of September 11th, they were having breakfast together, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was a whole series of snippets in the news and reports to the fact that Pakistan's ISI were covertly supporting the hijackers. And then at the same time, the head of Pakistani intelligence met up with the U.S. State Department, with Colin Powell, et cetera, and made the firm commitment that Pakistan would wage the war on terrorism against Afghanistan. So this was all part of the propaganda preparation of 9/11 to pin it on the state sponsors. And at the time, the state sponsors, which were mentioned, was Pakistan, or segments within the Pakistani intelligence community on the one hand, and two, the Taliban. Okay, now it just so happens that the so-called Taliban
contacted the Washington and said, okay, if you want Osama bin Laden, we'll be happy to hand him over. And then, of course, there was another occurrence which was confirmed by the report of Dan Rather, and it's important, is that on the 10th of September, Osama bin Laden was hospitalized in Pakistan. It's well documented, and we don't know when he was released, but he wasn't released before September 11th. But his whereabouts were known. His whereabouts were known. They could have arrested him, and then we wouldn't have had a war. We wouldn't have had a war in Afghanistan, and we wouldn't have had the war against Iraq. But the saga required precisely that bin Laden survive and that al-Qaeda len should be sustained and that they were pinpointed as being responsible for these attacks, which even Bob Graham says, no, it's impossible. So he's contradicting himself.
Okay. I know you don't have a lot of time with us, but I wanted to bring up one more point. Now, you talk about Senator Graham is essentially being part of the propaganda apparatus, and I'm wondering if there isn't a little bit more method to this madness around implicating the Saudis, because we remember we heard way back when, as you mentioned, Afghanistan was initially implicated without evidence. Then later on, Iraq was implicated as having some supported the Osama bin Laden. Factually erroneous, but no matter. I'm wondering, are we possibly looking at some kind of a military or other intervention into Saudi Arabia? I'm just wondering if what the geostrategic or geopolitical ramifications of this accusations against Saudi Arabia, what is playing out here in the broader geopolitical field? Do you have any insights into that?
Well, you know, they're blaming everybody for supporting bin Laden. Iran was also blamed, and there was a lawsuit against Iran by the victims of 9/11. It's clear that as far as Washington is concerned, Saudi Arabia is a very staunch ally. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are relays for the recruitment, the financing of political Islam, of the various al-Qaeda linked organizations on behalf of the CIA, always on behalf of the CIA. That's known and documented for years and years. And Saudi Arabia acts in unison with its U.S. partners. But at the same time, by accusing Saudi Arabia, it's a way of, in effect, maintaining preventing Saudi Arabia from exercising any kind of regional mandate. It really keeps Saudi Arabia as a proxy state. And you keep Saudi Arabia as a proxy state by collaborating with Saudi Arabia, as Saudi Arabia is waging a war against Yemen on behalf of the United States. Very convenient. And at the same time, you pressure Saudi Arabia in a way which is not always friendly, not necessarily the Saudi royal family, but members of the members of the business establishment who may have funded the terrorists, their foundations, and so on and so forth. And that serves, in a sense, to keep Saudi Arabia more or less entrapped in obeying and taking orders from Washington and not exercising any role as a sovereign state. It's not a sovereign state; it's a proxy state, and so are the Gulf. I mean, the Gulf monarchies. It's a larger sovereign state. Proxy state than, let's say, the Emirates or Qatar. But nonetheless, these countries really are serving U.S. interests. They buy U.S. weapons. They buy British weapons. They wage the war in Syria by funding the ISIS, Daesh, and they invade and bomb Yemen again in very close coordination with Washington.
That almost sounds like what I'm hearing from you is that it's like, yeah, sure, just as the Taliban at one point was an ally back way in the 1990s, but they eventually kind of stepped out of line and had to be overthrown. And I guess it's almost as if they're saying, okay, Saudi Arabia, know your place. This is like a warning, that this effort to just implicate them is just a kind of a way of saying don't, like you say, don't exercise your rights as a sovereign country.
Well, now there's a motion in the U.S. Senate to allow the victims of 9/11 to wage legal procedures. In fact, those legal procedures started very early and then they were stalled against Saudi Arabia. And, you know, there's money behind it. There's money. If you wage a $1 trillion lawsuit against Saudi Arabia, there's money to be made. And if it has the support from high up, it has, you know. So this is a way of, it's part of the workings of a global economic geopolitical system, is that you don't want your allies in the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia, Turkey. I mean, if we're talking about the two countries which are supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria on behalf of the United States, you don't want them to gain any kind of hegemony or regional hegemony. But you use them, in this particular case, you're using them to support your intelligence assets, namely Al-Qaeda. And then you say, oh, you're supporting Al-Qaeda. We're going to go after you. And they can always, and then selectively the media will say, oh, Turkey and Saudi Arabia is supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria. I mean, these admissions have been made. What they don't say is that Saudi Arabia does it on behalf and in response to instructions which are relayed, you know, from Washington, from U.S. intelligence.
Okay. Well, Michel Chosadovsky, I guess we'll let you go now, but I want to thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
We've been speaking with Professor Michel Chosadovsky, award-winning author, professor emeritus of economics at the University of Ottawa, and founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. Barry Zwicker is a veteran broadcaster, print journalist, and media critic. Since 2001, he's become increasingly known for his work promoting 9/11 truth, and 10 years ago authored the book Towers of Deception, the Media Cover-Up of 9/11. He joins us now from Toronto to share some of his thoughts on the 15th anniversary of 9/11. Glad to have you back, Barry Zwicker.
Well, I'm glad to be back. Thank you, Michael.
Now, you had already, in 2001, you'd already been reporting on how mainstream media tends to ignore stories that challenge dominant power interests, you know, whether it's, oil industry-owned media tend not to do a very good job of climate change research, or defense contract-owned TV outlets tend not to give you the most comprehensive analysis of, say, the first Gulf War in 1991. So I was wondering if you could look back on your experiences trying to interest the mainstream media in the 9/11 question, and relate any specific instances of suppression or even willful blindness or what have you that surprised even you at that time, and possibly surprise you even to this day.
Well, indeed. I do tend to be surprised or alarmed or despairing at the continuity of the de facto censorship exerted by the mainstream media, and it did well precede 9/11. But 9/11 is the probably classic case of censorship, blanket censorship across mainstream media, certainly. And there were two personal experiences, or at least one for sure, that I've had with 9/11 propaganda and control, to take that general heading, control of the media. And I'll just focus on 9/11 anniversaries alone, and just specifically two, the 4th anniversary and the 15th. Now, it's important, I think, to bring up a quotation from American social critic Larry Ray in this connection. He said, quote, "Anniversaries are reservoirs of sacred power." And this quote is quite pertinent to us discussing this today on a personal level. For instance, wedding anniversaries. are occasions for celebration. But Ray is referring to events that the culture decides are important, such as the sinking of the Titanic or the coming 150th birthday of Canada. Now, the fourth anniversary of 9/11 was in 2005. It fell on a Sunday, as it did this past Sunday, for only the third time. And in late August of 2005, as can be found in the first chapter of my book that you mentioned, Towers of Deception, the Media Cover-Up of 9/11, I submitted an article. And, well, let me just quote briefly from my own book for a moment. This is how chapter one starts. August 22nd, 2005. This morning, I submit an article on spec to Peter Scowen, editor of the Ideas section of Sunday, the Sunday edition of Canada's largest circulation newspaper, the Toronto Star. The focus of the article, 9/11, is timely. It's 20 days before the fourth anniversary of the event. It happens to fall on a Sunday, which won't happen again until 2011. And at 4,500 words, the article is within the range Sunday publishes. While writing the article, I enlisted the help of distinguished writer colleagues more than I usually do. Several are more accomplished than writers than I am. They contributed improvements. They all praised the article in its near final form. So just a word here needs to be said, since this is a personal account of me and media control. A word needs to be said about the Sunday Star at that time. First of all, it was published by the most left-leaning daily newspaper in Canada then and probably now. Beyond that, the Sunday Star editorial unit was vibrantly progressive at the time, and the Ideas section within it even more so. And, for instance, just a brief instance, it had published an article written by a lawyer. And this article, I'm just looking it up quickly here right now. This article was by a lawyer, and it was headed Fascism Then, Fascism Now? ? And in this lengthy article, he wrote, the lawyer, North America is on a fascist trajectory. We must recognize the threat for what it is, and we must change course. He commented by exploring the disturbing parallels between our own time and the era of overt fascism, we can avoid the same hideous mistakes. And he goes on. And my gosh, you know, he was just being prescient when you look at Donald Trump and the alt-right movement. Anyway, long story short, Peter Scowen, who was the editor I submitted my piece to, turned down my article. I'd suggested the headline, which really fitted the Sunday Star, Your Sunday Puzzle, Three Amazing Secrets About 9/11. Sort of a typical kind of a grabby headline. Now, I didn't document my experience with Peter Scowen and the Sunday Star in my book because of sour grapes. Not at all. It was much more important than that. Sour grapes, you know, would be really nothing. It was a fine progressive paper's missed opportunity to speak truth to power. Because if there ever was a country, a city, a paper, an editor, and timing that could create a stir over the anomalies of the official 9/11 story, it would be Canada, Toronto, Sunday, Peter Scowen, the Ideas section, and the fourth anniversary of 9/11. Now, two more points about this personal experience. Peter Scowen himself had written a book, I've got it right beside me, entitled Rogue Nation, The America the Rest of the World Knows, sharply critical of U.S. foreign policies, and which contains a full account of the role of the CIA in overthrowing the democratic government of Iran in 1953. And on that second point, let me quote from Peter Scowen's book, okay? And it suggests what he knew and did not know about the events at Ground Zero on the morning of 9/11. He has a sister, Amy, who was an office worker on the 54th floor of the South WTC Tower on 9/11. P- Peter, being an alert journalist, recorded a telephone interview with his sister later that day. And in the transcript, this is from Peter's book, we find this. Here's what his sister Amy said. And then we were walking up Broadway and went into a store to get a battery for our cell phones. And we heard a radio broadcaster describe how she had been at the base of the building when a huge fireball exploded out of the basement of the building. She was implying there was a bomb in the basement of the World Trade Center as well. So the thing is that Peter Scowen has the political background, and he had the firsthand experience with his sister of knowing that something was seriously amiss about the official story of 9/11, even as reported in his own paper and all other papers. And this speaks, I think, for itself, except to finish off this sort of your double-barreled question to me about media control. We can come down to this past weekend, the 15th anniversary of 9/11, and it relates to what Peter Scowen's sister Amy reported. And in this past weekend, there was a tremendous conference in New York City, a two-day conference entitled Focus on Justice. And during that two-day conference, where experts on 9/11 testified, and including by Skype from various countries around the world, about the details of the anomalies and the absurdities and the contradictions in the official story of 9/11, and Graham McQueen, Professor Graham McQueen of McMaster, who had studied and did a paper on all 12,000 pages of post 9/11 interviews with emergency personnel in New York. These are pages kept secret until the New York Times launched a lawsuit against the city and forced these transcripts of these interviews into the public arena. In them, dozens of New York firefighters and Port Authority personnel testify as to these explosions that Peter's sister Amy referred to at the base of all three towers, you know, WTC 1 and 2 and WTC 7. And then to just complete the circle here, if you fast forward to last Sunday, the 15th anniversary, the coverage in the newspapers and elsewhere ranged from the maudlin to the bizarre. For instance, long human interest stories about individuals who were in the Twin Towers but survived, stories about the fragment of a girder from one of the towers that the city of New York gave to the citizens of Gander, Newfoundland, because those citizens took in the stranded airline passengers on the day of 9/11. A lot of coverage of a stage play by a husband and wife, one Canadian, one American team, that touches in a totally non-factual, non-political way on 9/11.
Fluff, basically.
Play is coming to Canada. It's just, this censorship goes on and the distraction goes on.
Well, I think we're going to have to call to close it here. Thanks so much for coming on and sharing these thoughts on this 15th anniversary occasion.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you.
We've been joined by Barry Zwicker, a veteran broadcaster, print journalist, and media critic. He is based in Toronto. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. The Global Research News Hour welcomes new affiliate Caper Radio CJBU 107.3 FM out of Sydney, Nova Scotia, who will begin airing the program on Wednesday mornings from 8 till 9 a.m. Check out their website at caperradio.ca. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.